Okay. All righty. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us for the Oregon Investment Council. Before I turn it over to Chair Russell, I wanted to go over a few details. Please know that this meeting is being recorded, and the audio portion will be available on the Treasury website shortly after the meeting. Second, there is on the Teams app or within the browser, there is a Q&A function at the bottom. Please use these for any kind of tech issues and also for providing any kind of public comments. Lastly, there is also a closed captioning function that is also at the bottom there as a list of some of the tools as part of Teams. So again, thank you very much for joining us today. And with that, I will turn it over to Chair Russell.
Meeting is called to order, and the first item is review and approval of minutes. Is there a motion to approve?
This is Patricia. I'll move to approve.
Is there a second?
This is Monica. I'll second.
Any objection to the minutes? If hearing none, if they're approved. Rex?
Actually, I think the vice chair.
Pardon?
The vice chair election.
Mr. Chair, I would, this is Tobias, I'd like to nominate Ms. Samples to fill the role of vice chair.
And this is Patricia. I'll second.
All those in favor of the motion, please signify by saying aye or raise your hand.
Aye.
Aye. Done.
And Mr. Chair, thank you to the vice chair, the new vice chair.
Thank you.
And Patty, we all owe you an enormous debt of gratitude for your service. This is your last meeting, we're told, unless we can convince you to stay on for the February meeting. But in any case, you've been a very valuable addition to the council, so thank you very much.
You're here.
Thank you.
Rex, calendar approval?
Yes. So on your screen are the proposed OIC meeting dates for the year of 2022. 2021 is already approved. So if there is a motion to approve this calendar as listed.
Mr. Chair, I move approval of the proposed 2022 meeting schedule for the Investment Council.
And this is Monica. I'll second.
It's been moved and seconded. Unless there's any objection, they're approved.
Okay, and then thank you for that. And then wanted to go over the most recent activities within the committees. To start with the Real Estate Committee, on December 11th, the committee approved $150 million for Harrison Street Real Estate Partners Fund 8, $200 million for HSOR Life Science Partners. The Alternatives Portfolio Committee, actually this was via staff authority approval. Per IMV 702, the Chief Investment Officer approved a $50 million investment based on the recommendation from the Director of Private Markets and the OIC's consultant, Axia Torkove, for, again, $50 million in Brookfield Infrastructure Co-Investment Sidecar. Then on December 7th, per IMV 701, Chief Investment Officer approved, based on the recommendation of both the Director of Private Markets and the OIC's consultant, Axia Torikov, a $50 million investment for Clearview OPERF. And then lastly, the Private Equity Committee on January 22nd approved the following investments, $350 million for Hellman & Freeman Capital Partners 10, $150 million for Luminant Capital Partners 3, and $250 million for Rourke Capital Partners 6. Thank you.
So the next item is Jeff Nolan on short-term fund policy revisions.
All right. Good morning, Chair Russell, Treasury, members of the Council. For the record, my name is Jeff Nolan, SIO of Fixed Income. Today, I'm going to be walking you all through a proposed update to policy INV-303 with regards to clarifying and firming up some of the language around the use of repurchase agreements, or repos, as I'll refer to them during the presentation. This policy update has already passed muster with the Oregon Short-Term Fund Board, which we presented it to them last Thursday. If you could turn to page 3, you have seen this slide before, so I'm not going to walk you through it. You saw it back in December when we brought a policy update for OITIP, and so I'm not going to walk you through it. It's pretty straightforward, but we did follow the same policy and got feedback from the legal team, compliance, risk, as well as the external consultant, Makita. If you could then turn to page 5, please. So just a little bit of background on the policy 303 and repos before we get to the details. Policy 303 are the portfolio rules or the guidelines for the short-term fund. Within that policy, repurchase agreements or repos are already an approved asset class. Historically, we haven't used them because the legal setup documentation is quite heavy, requiring one-on-one negotiations with each of the counterparties or the dealers. And then additionally, the collateral requirements really weren't, as they're currently drafted, really weren't of much interest to dealers. So the benefits are pretty straightforward, but I would like to emphasize that, you know, repos are secured with collateral that are topped up daily. You can get a slight pickup in yield, and it doesn't sound like much, but in the current low interest rate environment, you know, if we can get an extra basis point or two and on a secured basis, you know, that's a win. If you could, excuse me, turn to page 6, please. So on this page, I'm not going to read each line as it's fairly straightforward, but I would like to encapsulate the changes if I could. Really, they're around clarifying and firming up the guardrails within which the short-term fund can trade repos. Now, the changes at one of the themes is the changes actually make it more conservative relative to what it was. So we're limiting ourselves to primary dealers. I mean, these are some of the biggest, strongest banks on the planet. So think of a JP Morgan or a Bank of America. We are also requiring the use of a tri-party custodian who effectively sits in between ourselves and the counterparty and does a lot of the operational work. The second theme is it enhances the investment opportunities for the short-term fund by making those collateral requirements more attractive to the dealers. And then third, it eliminates unnecessary and confusing counterparty language that was in the current draft. So if we turn to page 7, please. So I've already encapsulated the themes are there as well. So the fixed income staff at Oregon State Treasury actually recommends approval of the policy updates. And if you have any questions, I'm happy to take them.
Jeff, as John Russell, you deserve a lot of credit for navigating through all the approval process to get us to this point. My sympathies.
Thanks.
This is Member Samples. I don't have a issue with this recommendation at all, but I did want to point out, you know, in the materials as well as your comments mentioning, you know, limiting ourselves to primary dealers and that making us more conservative. I just want to mention that in 2008, even those primary dealers that you mentioned were not necessarily safe or conservative or high-quality counterparties. So I'm sure that you're taking that into account. I just kind of want to go on the record mentioning it.
Sure. And I think, you know, that's a fair statement. But in the subsequent 10, 12 years, given all the regulations by the, you know, on the federal level with all of these banks, they are, in my humble opinion, like virtual fortresses at this point. So you know, and the key point here is these are the collateral is held at a tri-party custodian, and it's topped up every single day. So if something went wrong, we can get our hands on the collateral right away. And we're not, you know, we're not, it minimizes sort of the credit counterparty risk.
Thank you.
So there's a staff recommendation to modify the policy. Is there a motion to that effect?
So moved.
It's been moved. Is there a second?
Mr. Chair, with great appreciation for Ms. Sample's caution, I'm happy to second.
It's been moved and seconded with caution. All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Hearing none, it's approved.
All right. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
So the next item on the agenda is a presentation by Jim Coulter and of TPG. He's the co-founder and co-CEO. And if I may, I'd like to introduce him with a quick story, a brief story. When I joined the council, I was told that there are continuing education requirements. And I was presented with this bewildering array of all of the opportunities from Ottawa to whatever. And so I went to Sherbum, the CIO, and said, Jim, help me out here, John. And he explained them. He said, well, there's one that you just have to do, and that is you have to show up at the TPG annual meeting in Scottsdale. Because in the course of that two-day session, you'll hear Jim Coulter give a 90-minute presentation about global finance, and there may not be anybody in the world better than Jim Coulter to do just that. So, Jim, we're honored to have you. And I understand that you have agreed to stay on after the presentation to answer questions about the world and global finance. So thank you.
I may not have answers, but I'll certainly take questions, Chairman Russell. Well, thank you all for having me, Chairman Russell, Treasurer Reed, Member Samples, Member Zinenda. It's a pleasure to be in front of you. And as I was putting this together, and I promise you it won't be 90 minutes, I thought of the first time I came before this council. And Jimmy, if we can put up the slides here. It was 1992. It was a different era. And it was a time where private equity had not really even been named yet. And to think about that moment, we were managing $64 million. We were raising our first fund. The entire industry was $60 billion, and you had one person in the Oregon alternative investment area. So we've been on a 30-year journey together. If we look at that journey today, what's changed least is you are still the most efficient system people we see in the system. But we've been on a path that's been one of growth. We've invested billions of dollars together. We've had some great wins. We've had some challenges. And over that 30 years, we've delivered to you unrealized deals probably double, a little more than double what the market did. And we've learned a lot. And what our goal today is, at the request of the team, is to, at this moment in the world and at this moment in your private equity path, to give a different sort of presentation to you. Normally you would hear from consultants who would talk to you about quartiling and dispersion and lots of graphs and charts on cohorts. And the team asked me to do something different. I live at the front edge of what's happening out there, deploying your capital. And so if I were sitting in your seat and thinking about the path ahead for private equity, what would I be thinking about? Because the decisions you make today will guide the evolution of your portfolio, not just for the year ahead, but for the 10 years ahead. And I'm going to have a more of a plain spoken type of a presentation here, because I think this is such a complex market that the value is often in simplicity. So what we're going to do is look at three things. I'm going to take you behind the curtain. going to talk about how it's evolving and then my suggestions for the path ahead. At your team's request, each of those is about 10, 15 minutes. We'll stop because we'll all have Zoom fatigue. We'll take some questions, hopefully. And then, as Chairman Russell said, I'm happy to speak on what the heck is happening with GameStop, et cetera, if you want to at the end of this presentation. So first of all, how and why it works. And Treasurer Reid will be familiar from the political world that sometimes what you hear and what's actually going on is different. And so as you sit at these presentations, you're going to see incredible stories of eye-popping returns. They wouldn't have gotten past the staff and to you if they didn't have a good story. But what I would suggest to you is to stop and think about what's really going on behind those returns, because that's the truth of this industry. And simply, I think of private equity as investors with a more complete tool set. I started my career in the public market back in 1986, and picking stocks is a tough job. You essentially have an entire department of the government called the SEC designed to make sure you don't have the information you need to keep the playing field fair. And there's not a lot you can do. You can buy and you can sell. Occasionally, you can run a political campaign called activism to try to make some minor changes. You can, and you can use these instruments that, as you were just talking about, the repo market can sometimes come and bite you if you're not careful. So after a number of years of doing this, and which I felt like I was wielding a pretty dull axe, I ended up moving my career over to private equity. I didn't get any smarter when I made that move. I was pretty good at stock picking, but things got better when we moved over to private equity because I found we had a different toolbox. So suddenly I could get full information. I could ask any question I wanted. Yes, I gave up some liquidity, but I'm not a short-term person anyhow. And we could do roll-ups. We could add leverage to the balance sheet. We could change management in an afternoon if we wanted to. We could bring in experts to redirect the strategy of the company. And so it's not, and please don't quote me on this, it's not that private equity is any more brilliant. It simply has better tools to deliver the types of returns that you and we want to. So the question as you're listening to setting your portfolio is this a firm that is building the tools? What tools are they using, and are they continually sharpening them? Why is this important? If you go to the next slide, McAfee is a software company we bought from Intel, so Intel was considered well-managed at the time we were doing it. WellSky is a company we bought from another private equity firm. These were smart people that own these assets. But if you look at what we did with these companies, McAfee, we more than doubled the profitability. And WellSky, we actually doubled down on our product spending and doubled the growth. So by not only buying these companies, but evolving them, we're able to deliver 4 to 8 times returns on these deals. And the leverage really had very little to do with it. It's all about this type of change. So it's about the toolbox. Next point I make is probably the most important tool is governance. And if I were to describe private equity, if I was really put back against the wall, it is a governance model. I know a number of you, I think members Ian had samples, you've sat on public boards, and I've sat on public boards. The public market governance system is very flawed with good intentions all around. But if you think about how it works as a supply chain, and I think of it as supply chain. Supply chains, you need to have coherent information and aligned specs. So you have shareholders in the public market who come and go. They communicate through something called proxies. Then you have a board which is elected by those proxies but kind of appointed by management. The board has no staff. Management has full staff. Management controls the information. Management is trying to do the right thing, but is it dealing for short-term or long-term? It's just complex. So it's good people caught in a system that is not optimized. You go to the public market or the private market and think of this supply chain. First of all, there is a supply chain manager called the private equity firm. Our job is to manage this whole process. And I run a lot of supply chains. You want a supply chain manager. Information can flow. Alignment can be clear. Long-term incentives are set up, and there is no barrier between the shareholder and management. The board is optimized for the task at hand. So this difference in governance model is part of what makes it. And as you listen to people presenting, how are they governing these companies? To give you an example of this in action, when I was here before, Chairman Russell challenged me on diversity. And if you listen to the public markets now, there's a discussion of diversity going on. And it's very indirect. It's Goldman won't take someone public without women on the board. You know, NASDAQ wants to affect the listing rules. Somebody might vote their proxies. We woke up 2 years ago and said we can do better. And we built a 1,500-person database, and we went after gender diversity on our boards. We've added, actually, as of yesterday, it's 100 females to our board. Now we're going after broader diversity. 25% of these ads have been diverse, but now we're going for diversity on all sorts. And this is a governance choice. And using a term that is well-known in your area, private equity governance allows you to just do it. And that is powerful. Next slide, please. The other reason we do well is we actually have a more interesting playing field. And so it's hard to say a lot against the public market when things have been going as well in the public market in the last decade as they have. But underneath the covers, there's some real questions as to what's happening in the public market. So I was shocked when I found this data years ago, but the number of U.S. public companies is down almost 50%. Recently, it's ticked up a little bit, but it's still a much tighter playing field as share buybacks and mergers have shrunk the number of public companies. And if you look at NASDAQ last year, it was up 40%, but 40% of that gain was in six companies. The other 2,900 plus, you know, had nowhere near that type of performance. And the public markets have become smaller, more concentrated, and older over time. And you have to own a few numbers of companies. Those companies are driven by indexes. You see anomalies happening around that. So the public market has become more of a momentum expression of the economy and a little bit less a hunt for alpha. Now go to the other side of the ledger. The private equity area has gotten really interesting. So in 2000, there was only 1,500 companies in the private equity universe. Today, there are 17,000. And if you think about some of the most interesting companies in the world are the formerly called unicorns. They're now everywhere, so they can't be unicorns anymore. These are companies that live for longer in the private market. You can buy Airbnb in the public market today at $119 billion valuation, or you can do what you and we did together, which we invested at a $6 billion valuation back in 2014. And this ability to put private dollars into areas that are not yet expressed in the public market is part of the reason that this works. And then the last point, if I can touch on, is when you hear from people at the council, there's typically like a star. There's someone that's presenting. There's the leader. It's the company's named after them. And people misunderstand that this is a team sport. To do this over and over again, over decades, years, et cetera, it is not one person. Yes, you need that leadership, but you need to commit yourself to do what I do, which is I'm curating a massive ecosystem. And the information values of that ecosystem, the 10,000 pages of research we write for deals we don't do, is something that is extraordinarily powerful. So as you listen to people, how are they actually building their teams? So this idea of a team sport is something that I want to make sure that you're focused on. So as I think about, you know, behind the curtain, what we're really doing in this industry, there is a few implications that I would leave with you as you sort through the managers you wish to back. First of all, you want to find firms that are constantly building the toolbox and sharpening the tools, and you want to know what those tools are. There's a really hard thing that goes on, which is you have to manage the cost-quality trade-off. Absolutely, your team has to reduce fees wherever it can. But I would say it's a bit like, I don't know if you've done a house remodel, but if you do a house remodel, it's really dangerous to take the low bid, right? Because you can get someone with some pretty dull tools who will get the job done, but 10 years later, the house may not look so good. So one of the issues you have is you can measure fees day to day, but you can only measure returns over 10 years. And how do you actually balance that cost-quality trade-off? Let's improve our governance skill set. It's a huge opportunity for the industry at a time that governance at the corporate level is needed. And as we've gone from 1,500 companies in private equity to 17,000, it's no longer just okay to be on the field. You have to pick where you want to be on the field. We'll talk about this later. So specialization becomes important. And the last point is, in the early days of private equity, when I first came to you, we just had to invest well. Now we have to invest well and manage well. So that idea of understanding how the firms that you address are investing in addresses a question of management is important. And understand the people. There's a lot going on in the private equity industry, as in all industries, around people right now. It's not only about the transactions they do, it's about their compass. And if you're going to be with someone on a journey for 10 years, you want to understand their personal compass. I thought it was always great that people showed up at our meeting, Chairman Russell, in part because I think you got to know who we are, and that's part of the learning in this industry. So that's sort of section one. And again, I don't know if it's useful or not, but stripping down to what's really happening in this industry, I think, is important at a time that there's so much complexity coming in. Jim Russell, any questions around that, or can I go into some of the change that we're seeing and how that complexity is entering?
Any questions from council members? Seeing none, go ahead, Jim. Thank you.
Well, that's our base. That's what we have to do every day. The second thing I would counsel you is, as you're listening to the stories and kind of picking your managers, understand the context in which this industry is playing out. And I think too often we talk about individual deals and not the long-term nature of what's happening. So my father had a saying that confused me for a long time, which was a cobbler's children has no shoes, have no shoes. And the point is, often we don't pay attention to the things closest to us. And so in private equity, we study every other industry, but often we don't spend enough time studying our own and thinking about exactly how it's unfolding. And this is one of the most interesting industries I've ever seen. I mean, look at the growth rate in this industry. Over the 30 years, just an immense, you'd have to go into the microchip business to see this kind of growth. But within that growth, there's been distinct eras. So let me just tell you the background. The first era that when we first met was about naming the industry, and really it was about finance. It drives me nuts today that people say that private equity is Wall Street. I went back and looked at my last 100 calls. I had one call with a Wall Street banker. But it's a remnant of history. In the 90s, it was about leverage. We didn't touch companies. We basically just changed balance sheets in many cases. And that was the first era. But it hasn't been that way in 20 years. Today, our companies are no more leveraged than the market in general. The second decade post the 2000 bubble burst was really about operating value added. You started to have people really bring in operating expertise into the industry, and we extended into different industries, different areas, geographies, Asia, Europe, et cetera. Prior to 1998, there had never been a tech buyout. Think about that for a minute. So that was a totally new frontier in the 2000s. And then the last decade, post the global financial crisis, has been about specialization. So we've had a proliferation of products and a specialization within the industry and everything from credit to geographies. You know, today you can, if you go into the industry, you can invest in a cannabis fund. There's a Green Acre Cannabis Fund. You can do the SpaceX Space Frontier Fund. There's basically a fund for everything. And that complexity has multiplied in a decade. So this has created an incredible challenge for you and your team, because back in 1995, there were 22 funds greater than $1 billion. And if you look through that list, about half of them survived. About a third of them were tied to investment banks. Only one of the investment banks is still even in the business. It's not Wall Street anymore. But this is the market today. And poor Mike Langdon has to figure out what to do with that, you know, so small you can't even read the print type of complexity. So how is this all going to sort out? Go to the next slide. Often the complexity is blamed on the GPs, but what's also happened is an amazing amount of change, and this is something that I know you know, in the LPs. So in the 80s, it started with a few insurance companies. In the 90s, you really came to the forefront. The U.S. pension funds became the core to the industry, and Oregon was a clear leader and remains a leader today. In the 2000s, the sovereign wealth funds showed up. Right. These were massive pools of capital entering the marketplace with zero allocations, trying to get to 10%. In the last decade, we had a whole other set of sovereign wealth funds that I didn't even know existed. So Japan Post, Post Office Bank of Japan, is a $1 trillion pool of capital. NPS, the Korean pension fund, is bumping up against $1 trillion. today. And their new entrance in the market, the Chinese government reserves, is a $3 trillion fund, is active in the market today. And now, as we go into the next decade, we're seeing a individual wave of investors. So one of the real challenges for you as Oregon is you are leaders and innovators, and the market on your side of it has gotten substantially more complicated. So if you think about how that plays out, that complexity has meant that when we started to meet, you know, we were looking for a fund commitment. It was a transaction that we started the relationship with. But today you see people on your side of the table doing fund commitments, co-investments, direct investments. They're going long-term. They're doing secondaries. They're managing their accounts. They got SMAs. They actually buy pieces of the GPs. They're opening offices across the world. CPP, who I mentioned, Canadian Pension Plan, it's a $400 billion fund, so it's five times your size. And I checked last night, it has 1,900 employees working directly across these complex areas. And so what this means is people are having to set up strategies in a way they never had to before. It's not just in the market. It's in the early days of private equity, I only had to ask questions like, what's your allocation? How much? Now, when I sit down with LPs, it's how. And today, when I go visit an LP, usually the first half of the meeting is them telling me how they're approaching the market. Next slide. So in this complexity, you have a choice. And forgive the graphics here, but this is a little bit how things are sorting out. You can go to the right side. There are 5,000 managers who are doing some really interesting stuff, right? But if you build a portfolio there, and many people did, they suddenly woke up and they had hundreds of managers, many of which didn't have any longevity. They weren't well managed. They were going in and out of favor. And people who went and built a portfolio there have generally regretted it. On the other end, if you're Japan Post, you have to have someone who's going to be around a long time, and you got to scale with them. So you've gone towards larger platforms, many of them public in the market. And others have managed through the middle. Generally, what I see people do is creating a barbell where they're picking some special things that they want to express on one side, and then they're building relationships on the other side that will multi-products where they can manage their portfolio by having long-term relationships. I mean, I was listening to your notes. This is, I think, in some ways how you're doing it, because you're expressing life science partners on one side, and then you've got Rourke 8 on the other, Rourke 6 on the other, which is something that you've been following over time. So this strategy of how you sort out the complexity, I've always admired Oregon because you have, with a very small team, have stuck clearly stuck to what you've done. In fact, looking at your numbers, if there's any stumble, it's only when you have diverted from the kind of steady, here's what we do path that you've seen any diversion in your results. And so this idea of being true to your strategy is key. So let me just end on this one. So as you think about the backdrop that you're expressing your decisions in, you have to choose your business model. You have to staff it the right way. And GPs and LPs, GPs are either choosing to be a platform and serving people who need that, or they're choosing to be point products. And LPs basically have to decide not only how much they want in private equity, but how they do it. One of the, and I'm going to get nuanced for a second here, one of the problems with this additional complexity in the marketplace is that the traditional ways of measuring performance don't work anymore. So back in the 90s, we came up with this unique idea of quartiling. And quartiling kind of worked because there was persistency among managers and the market was the same. If you go back and look at that list of 1995 GPs, they were all doing the same thing. So it was fair to measure them the same way. So as you get a more complex market, you see something that happens in the public market happening where the sector factors or product factors overcome the manager persistency. Let me give you an example of that. If at the beginning of the last sector, the last decade, you happen to have a software fund, whether it's in the public market or private market, I can tell you just on that fact that you outperformed because the neighborhood you were in either by choice or by pure luck, is the right neighborhood. And so now take a generalist fund who maybe is pretty good at software, but that's only a quarter of what they do. When you're asked to make the next fund cycle decision, it's not just on the persistency and quality of that manager. It's you have to make a call on software for the next decade. Has it run too far? Does it have farther to go? So the whole quartiling system has broken down as we've added complexity on it. If you could perfectly quartile, I think management persistency is still there, but the sample size gets too small. So this measurement problem, your team now has to decide not just what's happened in the past, they have to decide what's going to happen in the future. And as you sit there, oddly, traditionally the market was about us as GPs competing for your capital. Now the LPs are actually competing for mindshare because we can't have the sort of special relationship we have with you, with all of our LPs, where I'd be doing this presentation daily. So we have to create relationships, and there is a two-way competition. And so the relationship, we've moved over 30 years from a transactional connection to a relationship connection. I think that's a good thing, given the long-term nature of this. So let me stop there just for, again, Chairman Russell, for any questions on kind of how this evolution is happening, or if you want to, since I talk to a lot of CIOs, if you want to know how other people are thinking about this, but it's a different market than it was when we first engaged.
Any questions? I have a question, Jim. Just in thinking about the value of public companies, the transition from one CEO to another is pretty prescribed. Not perfect by any means, but in terms of private equity companies, that's not quite so clear. We're investing for a decade, and we don't know necessarily what the private equity management system is going to be. Does that make any sense?
Succession is one of the important things that we do in any corporate investing. And let me talk to this in the context of what I said before about a toolbox. We figured out at TPG in about 2000 that the most important tool is talent. And so we created an internal human capital, basically an internal search firm that quietly, for example, across our portfolio in the last 5 years, I think we've changed over 100 C-suite officers through internal. So we're in the business, Jim Russell, of those transitions and of constantly building and curating a list of people to do that, either internal or external. I would argue in the public market, succession well done works, but I've also seen in the public market that succession is a little bit like watching The Crown, like you're sort of, there's someone there waiting for who's going to come next, and as opposed to, is this really the person to run the country? Our job is to make sure that we're asking the question of who is this the right person to run the company, and to have both internal and external choices. So it's all about human capital.
But what my question really was about your own company.
Oh, our own company, yes. So, succession within private equity firms is interesting because David Rubenstein from Carlyle I would not say this, but he basically says, God must smile on private equity because they're all still around, right? So, if the length of succession, I don't agree with that, but I'm just saying that they're Kohlberg and Kravis, Kravis and Roberts are still around. Right. So I think what is happening now in the industry, and there was a really interesting article yesterday in Business Insider about John Gray of Blackstone. And why was that article there? It was a very positive article. Well, they're setting up a transition, right, in a big way. So in our industry, something I think about a lot, because we have always set this in our firm up as a team sport, I'm very comfortable with that. And I've always said personally that my job is to make sure when I retire from this business that no one notices. That's my job, because that means I built the right team to do this. But it's a good question. Too often, one of the question that I get so seldom from boards that is so important is how do you manage the place? Like, how do your incentives work? Like, how do, you know, those are, because that, the culture and management of the firm that allows you to do this over and over and over again is greatly underappreciated.
And I had the pleasure of meeting in Scottsdale your co-CEO, very impressive person. Is that a, you don't see co-CEOs in the public market, do you?
No, you do in some. You do in partnerships often. Like if you look at this industry, you do have, you originally had Schwarzman and Peterson, you had Kravis and Roberts, you had Warburg and Pincus. You know, so there is a little bit of a structure there. But, you know, John was number two at Goldman, so he's managed much more complex things than we are. So that was really in creating a co-CEO-ship, which, you know, I don't know if it'll last forever in that sense, because in some cases, we've had 5 years of having the same meetings together, right? So that means we know each other, and we constantly wake up every day and say, what's our highest and best? But the ability to kind of build excellence in how we run the place is the focus that we were indicating when we brought in John. And it's been a very successful move for us. So let me end by talking about the path ahead and some things that I would be thinking about if I were sitting in your seat. And I did my first analysis of why there might be too much money in private equity in 1994 when there was about $50 billion. The constant question that I get is, you know, is there too much money in private equity? And excuse the complexity of the chart here, but what people miss is that private equity is in part about market share. And so from 1992 to 2018, private equity went from $50 billion to $3 trillion, but at the same time, the equity markets went up very substantially. So what happened is this investment vehicle with better results and better toolboxes went from 0.4% of the equity market to 3.4% of the equity market. Now, John, you live in the real estate market. The private markets in real estate are like 90% of the market. The private markets in corporate are 3.4%. And so what's going to happen going forward? Well, I wouldn't mind if we went back to 1992. This industry is going to probably continue to grow. And so if you put an 8% growth rate on the market and you basically take share from around 4 to around 8, which I think could very much happen as I look at the new pools of money coming into this, you could see the private equity industry continue to grow at a pretty extraordinary rate. And so when new entrants come in, I always tell them there's too much money, don't start a new firm. But if you look at it, the hydraulics of this marketplace means that if there's any share pickup, this industry will continue to grow. Next point is it will change. And one of the things, and this will be a major, and I welcome this, this will be a major shift in the marketplace, is we are entering the era of and. Over my career, I've seen a few major waves. Like I entered the business when it was about Friedman, it was about the beginning of share buybacks, it was shareholder primacy. Then there was a wave of the private markets. The last decade we had waves of indexes and digital and Ameritrade. The wave right now is what I'm calling the era of and. It's not only what you do, it's how you do it. And investors are asking corporations to do what they do better in a more responsible way. And so private equity as a place that can express that is going to be held to a higher standard, should be held to a higher standard. And at your level, you have to focus on this question, not just the returns, but how those returns were generated. This is something we're deeply engaged in. Your team is good at really challenging on this, but it is a full-on effort. So to give you a sense of what we're doing at TPG, you asked me about this, Chairman Russell, last time we were here, and we didn't really have the time to go over it, but we have entire department of people who are about how do we get better on things like employee engagement, benefits and policies, how we recruit to get diversity into our system. And it is a full-on effort. We are leaders in the marketplace on impact investing. This is a way of us expressing our values while also generating high returns. And we have to work every day to change our census. So we told you what we did on boards. Our last class was greater than 50%. Diverse. We're the first large firm named the top firm from the Private Equity Women's Investors Network. And with all that, we're not doing enough, right? This industry is too white, it's too male, and it has to change. So this idea of holding your GPs and holding yourselves to that right balance of what you do and how you do it is going to be one of the big themes and a welcome theme of the coming decade. The second, this is the hardest one, but to my view, maybe the most important for you, is the next decade will require you to innovate. And for a long time, Mike would tell you, don't do first-time funds, right, Mike? That was like through the 2000s. And the reason was there were some really schlocky first-time funds. But as LPs got better at choosing, and as the industry had more and more experienced talent, somewhere in the last decade, actually, first-time funds started outperforming, and second products started outperforming flagships. And the reason for that was people got better at choosing and got better at deploying these new efforts. And the reality of this industry is that it's almost designed to destroy innovation, because the best way to raise money is to say, 5 years ago, I did this deal. I made a bunch of money doing it. And if you give me money, I'll do the same deal for the next 5 years. Like, that's a great way to raise money. It's a terrible way to invest. So you're going to have to think about, in this more complex market, how do you express innovation? I think what you did coming out of the global financial crisis, where you set up kind of an innovation portfolio, that was market leading. I quote it all over the world, because you were willing to innovate. Even with your small team, you were able to find a way to innovate. Let me show you just briefly, and I'll only talk my book for a moment here, you know, what innovation looks like in this market. So you may have seen we're launching a large climate effort. Why are we doing that? We've been talking about the why of climate investing for decades, but quite frankly, it hadn't really happened. And about 2 years ago, we saw a massive change in our portfolio, our pipeline, and four things happened. The net zero pledges, particularly corporate net zero pledges, people now have to act on that. Secondly, consumers now want to buy green, so 55% of CPG growth over the last 5 years has been in green products. Think about that. All the growth is in green products. Investors now care. And the most important thing is we've had a technological shift. Battery costs are down 90%. Solar costs are down 90%. EVs are grid parity. So top down, bottoms up, there's a sudden thing. Everyone's focused on GameStop. Look at Tesla stock. Look at Nia stock, right? The hottest things in the public market is people saying, how do we get money? But who's building these companies? Like, as they move out of venture, which is where we caught Airbnb and Uber, and they scale, how is that happening? And if you look at the market today, if you go to the next slide, if you want to express your belief in natural resources, which I hope you're not doing, or technology, there are hundreds of funds that are focused exactly on those. If you want to express your belief in climate, there's very few, and there's only like one fund building companies in climate greater than $1 billion. So we're gonna build a leader in that area, because we've learned over time that specialized sector work builds a flywheel of knowledge, and it allows our LPs to express what they want to do in a specific way. And I can tell you I'm happy to talk about this later, but it's so clear to me now, the next 30 years, the climate revolution is going to look like the digital revolution of the last 30 years. And Mike, you know, you would have liked to have gotten in specialized focused funds 30 years ago in technology. And Tesla is like AOL. It's like the first thing you're going to see. We haven't created the Google yet of the climate revolution, and that's, you know, that has to happen. So innovation. And lastly, and I'll end on this, I think relationships will continue to matter, in some ways will matter more. So we're going to come out of the COVID world here. It's my seventh crisis. We've been through five of them together with you. If I look around most private equity firms, less than half the people have been through one crisis before COVID. Right, so this idea of how are we going to steer the path ahead, I think there will increasingly, around all the volatility, be a value in longevity and relationships. And this is some place that Oregon has really, really differentiated themselves. And I really applaud you for it. It wasn't important when everything was up and to the right, or wasn't as important. It's going to be really important in the decade ahead. So let me end just if you want to, John, we talk about what my swing thoughts are, like what I'm trying to do here. And I don't play golf, but I took a couple of golf lessons and this idea of, like, how do you keep yourself focused when all hell is breaking loose around you? There's a few things on my mind. But let me stop there because I think we've used our time and ask John if, you know, but he'd like me to comment on this or on anything else in the market.
Well, Jim, that's a very generous opening for questions. So, council members, you're looking at one of the global giants of finance. We've got a few minutes of his time to hear him out. Sarah, I can see you.
I have two questions, so I can articulate both of them and let you answer. The first is pretty straightforward, which is, you know, you mentioned LPs are competing for GP mindshare as well as, you know, relationships becoming more important. So my question would be, you know, how can Oregon continue to compete? What are the things that we ought to be doing as an LP to get that kind of access to the top managers and top funds and build those relationships? And then my second question is just given the growth and maturation of the industry that you articulated in your presentation, should our long-term return expectations for this asset class potentially be coming down? And that's not meant to be a negative about the industry at mm-hmm. all, but rather, you know, as it grows and becomes more efficient, there's more capital, there's more liquidity. You know, it's as you mentioned, become a much more mature, populated industry. It's where all the companies are. And, you know, we use our long-term return expectations to set things like capital allocation, to think about things like our liabilities and how we'll meet them. So I think it's really important for us to have a be thinking about this appropriately.
Yeah, and those two questions are tied together because how you run your business will affect what those expectations should and can be. So let me take the second question first. It's clear to me that the raw numerical overperformance of the industry will probably come in as it matures. It industries normally do, but the percent outperformance versus the base rates are at extraordinarily high rates. So, you know, when to outperform by 500 basis points when the base rate was 15 when I started the business is very different from outperforming by 400 basis points when the base rates are 1. So in some ways, the I think about outperformance measured not in a numerical way, but in a relative way, and relative outperformance is actually in some ways more important today than it has been. But what it means, Kara, is this idea of innovation and choice is going to be more important. Because we were in the middle of an interest rate super cycle, right? Rates were going down, and when multiples expand, people who were just doing a beta play did just fine. So to bind the industry was helpful. So now choices are going to be more important. And the choices are who's using the toolbox well, and also this idea of innovation. You're going to have to innovate, Mike. Innovate more. Because just playing the market, I think, will ultimately, like all markets, you'll lose your premiums. So I think what you have is you have a great reputation among the GPs for being thoughtful, consistent, and knowing what you're trying to do. We see some of your peers where the staff keeps rolling over. You know, the new person has a new thing, and by the time they execute it, they're gone. You know, so the consistency and what are you doing? And Mike is very clear telling me what he's trying to accomplish, which is returns and consistency. That's your power. So use your size and your relationships and your consistency to play the game the right way. How you build the relationships is doing what you're doing, which is make it personal and go on the journey of innovation. There's two things that are really important to GPs besides capital. One is they love deals, and so the fact that you're doing some co-investing helps you connect with them on deals. So I think that's a good thing. And the second thing is, we as GPs, our business is damn complicated to run. We need to innovate. So let's innovate together on some things, because that has really high mind share. It has to have high, even more than the dollars that you put in. That innovation will allow you to put bigger dollars in themes later. It's really important to the GPs. It's really important to you. And like I've seen some of the big guys that I had up on there before, they say, well, if I can't put $500 million in it, I don't want to do it. Well, if you put $100 million in something and you learn about it, then you can put $500 million. By the time you can put $500 million in it, then it's probably well understood. So this idea of kind of innovating, focusing, curating the relationship is what I'd say. And if you do that, you can't beat the market. Care if you are the market. So if you do that, you can choose within that market as you have historically. Well, so it's about relationships and it's about innovation.
Let me take just a minute, if I may, to introduce you to the my other council members. Kara is a money manager in her own right. Monica Eland, very active in the VC world.
Yes.
Very grateful for her. Patty Moss ran a bank, retired, is on the board of a bank. So we're all appointed by the governor. And
Patty, I don't see on the screen, Patty, but you've sat on public boards, and I'm happy to talk about the governor's situation. But it's it's fascinating, John. You and I talked a little bit about this once. I've sat on 40 corporate boards. Indirectly, we've controlled thousands of board seats over the years. And until recently, no one ever asked me to talk about governance. So it's sort of an interesting world, because there's lots of academic study, but the practitioner of it, it's like climate. You go to a climate conference every day, but we don't need to talk about why we have to fix climate. We have to talk about how we're going to fix it. And, you know, our job is to just go do it. And, you know, that's the same thing with governments. You know, we got governance. We got to execute excellent governance over and over again, but it's not well understood.
Well, in the public markets, one of the biggest failures of the last decade is Boeing. Very important factor in the Northwest. The chairman and the CEO are the same person.
Yeah, let me give you another one, which is I actually did some study with GE. So GE board seat used to be like the Olympic medal of corporate America. And I went back and looked at the GE board. It's a 14-person board, 12 CEOs, 2 academics, and not a single investor, no experiential diversity. You know, when we put a board together, I think a board is like a really good dinner party. It works well if you have very interesting people from different areas who bring in different ideas. If it's the same people, it's a reunion. So we build boards like reunions, and we need to build them like good dinner parties with a little bit of tension to them. So if you looked at the GE board, these were absolutely fantastic people. They are great people. They totally screwed it up. And the reason is they didn't – great people put together the wrong way with the wrong incentives don't always lead to great outcomes. So that, I'm still trying to understand why it happens that way, but if you just looked at the resumes, you'd say, wow, but somehow, I don't know, somehow it just, you've got it, board governance is something different than what people normally think.
Any further questions?
Just on that topic, since you're on it, we know that for healthy conflict, we have to have trust, and for trust, you know, you have depth psychological safety. And when you think about governance and boards and bringing, especially as you say, like you're excited about being more than just shareholder primacy and thinking about lots of stakeholders and diversity, how do you think about creating diverse boards that have psychological safety, trust, so they can have healthy conflict like that?
Yeah.
What do you think?
So two things. The first thing is it's okay to have conflict. So one of the things, one of my mentors in this is a woman who's importantly, fortunately passed away, Kathleen Phillips, who was a Columbia professor, and she did a bunch of research on group dynamics. She did it, interestingly enough, with fraternities and sororities. And what she found is that if you had a group that was homogeneous, they would, and you gave them a task, they would make a decision, and they'd feel great about it.
Yeah.
And if you had a non-homogeneous, they would make a decision, and they would walk out of the room thinking they were totally wrong. It had been really hard. And the non-homogeneous was always a better decision, almost always. So the putting together diverse boards means you have to mix it up. So I think the first thing is you have to create the safety to mix it up. And then the other thing, Monica, is that we run our board meetings. We always do a dinner beforehand just for the board so that because people we connect the board members. We want them to see each other because there is a moment where boards make really hard decisions. And if they don't know each other, that's when it falls apart. So it's part about creating the safety for conflict, and it's part about getting people to really know each other. So I'd be happy to come talk to you sometime because I recently gave a presentation on it. You know, just the actual practical aspects of board governance. I interview people for board skills. Board skills are very different from CEO skills, very different. In fact, most CEOs, there's a reason CEOs like other CEOs on their board. I like a lot of investors on boards. Investors like ask tough questions. They can't manage anything, but they're going to grind it. And so this idea of, board diversity on every measure, but diversity of thought, safety of conflict is what you have to do.
It's a big topic for us, Jim, because we're dealing with the constraints of public meetings laws.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we can't have, although we're pushing the limits of that, we can't have a dinner together.
Yeah.
Let me ask you, you and I talked a little bit about a topic that just interests the hell out of me before the meeting. I think most of us have been to China to see airports that are brand new, highways that are fabulous, high-speed trains that go 200, 300 miles an hour, and yet it's called a developing country. Now, Biden has announced an infrastructure plan, but it's hobbled by the fact that nobody wants to pay for it. But, God, it just seems like we're losing ground, and there are some significant climate differences among people driving gasoline-powered cars and going to Chicago on a high-speed train. So where are we going?
In some ways, this is the arc of history. I remember the first time I went to London, Chairman Russell, and like, how does anyone get around that city, right? The streets are, so in some ways you have a late mover advantage where the U.S. could build its streets on a grid when London was still a mess and China and some of the developing countries as were able to build their infrastructure later, which is actually an advantage in everything from transportation to certain areas of, I remember, we've caught up now, but for a while, like you could get much better cell phone coverage in China than you could in the U.S., right, until we got it figured out. So this, I think, it's part of the, we're always going to be a little behind infrastructure from the people who built it most recently, which tells us we need to rebuild ours. Part of the reason I'm excited about what's happening with the climate area is it's going to require us to rebuild things. And what I believe in the U.S. is we tend to do the right thing only when, I think it was the Churchill said, U.S. does the right thing only when they've exhausted all their options. Sometimes we like have to get to the point where we have to act. And I hope that climate will be among the things that call us that we have to act. But, and this is, it's certainly true in climate, it's true of all this, we can't wait for government. There's not enough government money to do it. We have to create the private market, the government can light the flame, but the private market has to, produce the power, and that's what we all need to focus on. I do think that the digital market, the 30 years in the digital, things happen fast in the digital world, right? And they happen without much capital. Treasurer Reed, to give you a sense, in the 1900s, it took U.S. Steel 6% of GDP to be built. It took Facebook 0.001% of GDP in terms of capital to be built. And so we think that things just happen without capital, in this next era, what you're looking for, John, we're going to have to deploy capital. And by the way, that's a need. That's also a massive opportunity. I mean, rewiring for a non-carbon environment, that is the best investment opportunity that any of us are going to see for the next 30 years. Yeah, it's going to be expensive, but we better be doing it, because if it's expensive, it means somebody's doing it and someone is creating opportunities to make profits on it. You know, why is Tesla much bigger than GM? In any revolution, the value moves ahead of the volume. We will have carbon for a long time, but the markets will move to a post-carbon environment well before the world does. And that's why you need to get in front of these things. So long answer, but I hope that we will take this opportunity to rebuild our infrastructure. And another time we can talk about, you know, we're going into a world of China-U.S. competition, and that's going to be an interesting moment for investors. But I would argue that if you look back over the range of history, about the only time you had a single superpower was 1989 to recently. So, you know, and I'm not sure we did so well when we didn't have competition. If you look back at, you know, when it was U.S. versus Europe, or we had the Russian, you know, competition, we actually had some purpose and got things done. So maybe having a little competition, while some things will be taken away, perhaps it also creates some impetus for us to act, which is much needed.
I've got another question, if I may, but I'm happy to defer to my council members. Inflation. I'm assuming that we in the pension fund world would love to see inflation, because at least in Oregon, we have fixed rate obligations to our retirees. And I think the same thing is probably true with the federal government. It might like inflation. What are your predictions about that?
Like most of the world, first of all, I'm not an economist. I've called 9 in the last 5 recessions. So I think, but what I will say is this, there's a new term out there, modern monetary theory. And whenever you get like a modern, this time is different, I get really worried. So what I would say is, you're right. In some ways, the government has been trying to set up inflation. We've been below our inflation target for a long way. We just keep throwing more money at it, because as a levered, if you are owning levered equities long, inflation tends to be a good thing. And if you think of the U.S. government, it is a quite levered long equity, right? So the idea of devaluing your debt through inflation and revaluing your assets would be a good thing to solve some of the issues of this country. What I think is happening that is more pernicious, John, is that we have inflation. It's called asset inflation. You see it in Bitcoin and GameStop and, you know, the public markets, and that everything is measured in dollars. So the weak link is the dollar as a reserve currency. And so because we measure everything in dollars, we think markets are going up. Maybe they're just inflating. I don't know. So we have, to my eye, asset inflation without wage inflation, and that's sort of an odd how that sorts itself out. And what you may see is a combination of rising wage inflation and devaluation of the dollar, which would be a way of expressing on a global basket inflation in a different way. What I do know, and Treasury, if you look at the numbers, for good reasons, we've added between 40% and 70% to our cash balances around the world. Meaning we just have printed more money to solve this pandemic. That money will find some place to go, and that's what we're seeing in the markets right now. When will it end? I don't know. And the problem for all of us as investors is being early looks like being wrong. So if you go to the sidelines early, you Rex, I don't envy you that decision, because you got to buy insurance, but know that you probably can't see where the problem's going to come from. We didn't think it was a bat in China, right?
Well, if you wanted to cause inflation in the federal government, I presume that you would allow the dollar to depreciate so that German cars and Vietnamese T-shirts would get more expensive. Do you think that's being is that being purposely done?
I can't tell. The problem is when you say the government is going to allow or do, you know, the I think I've worried today about our connection between policy and reality and the ability of the actors to actually move what they think they're, you know, sometimes we all pull the levers and it's not clear they're connected to anything. And so if you look at policy, if I describe the policy of the last few years to Janet Yellen 10 years ago, I bet she would have said that sounds inflationary to me. I mean, I don't know that, but but it hasn't been. So we're pulling a lot of levers here, and I'm not sure that they're all connected, and I'm not sure that the rudder has yet turned. What I do is I try to go and pick good companies. That last slide just stands. So if I can leave you with a couple of swing thoughts, in this environment, you're going to have to go after alpha by finding companies, by finding areas of the sector that are areas of the economy that are in sectoral disruption. So, for example, investing in content has gotten real interesting when it's all moved to streaming. Like, there's how that sorts out can get you some alpha. Climate has gotten real interesting. You can't just buy the market today. Honestly, if you had bought the market the past 10 years, you would have done okay.
I apologize for having been away for a little bit. So there's some risk in this question that you already talked about it, in which case feel free to say, talk to your colleagues and get the short version. But I wonder if you might be willing to share a little bit your perspective on sort of short term versus long run and the pressure that everyone feels about the short term that plays out obviously in this context relative to COVID. But even in the pre-COVID times, there was a real push towards short term, and I imagine you feel that in your world pretty acutely. But at the same time, you know, we're long run investors, we have long run obligations, and I would think that part of your value is in identifying those long run trends. So how are you thinking about that tension between short term and long run these days?
Yeah. Did you ever watch the marshmallow experiment with
yes.
kids? I don't know. Yeah, you see, yeah, it's a little bit that, which is the good news for me is the marshmallows in the other room because it's incredibly if it's right in front of you, like the short, and you can grab the short term, it's really easy to get short term. And so the way our fund, if I wanted to sell everything tomorrow, I couldn't. Right. So in some ways, one of the benefits is the guardrails of you guys making commitments over a period of time and doing it, not trying to call the market in those commitments, you know, mix of innovation and steadiness. You know, that is the way to make sure you don't grab the marshmallow. One of the benefits, again, we're not smarter in private equity, but sometimes the strictures around us actually help us. So you want to make some long-term bets in a steady way. You want a dollar cost average, and private equity turns out to be a way to do that just mm-hmm. because of how the hydraulics work.
Fair enough. Thank you.
And by the way, I don't get paid on short. At the end of the day, the other thing about our structure is we only get paid when we return it to you, and that's kind of a good thing, which means that we got to focus on that day, not what the mark says.
Right.
Well, fellow council members, this may be one of the last opportunities to ask a question of a giant of finance, so speak up.
That scares me when you say that, John. It scares me.
Yeah. Hopefully that's about today and not about him.
Yeah.
Well, Jim, thank you for taking the time to chat with us. So you are held in such high regard.
Well, we appreciate the relationship, and all of you and the many members before you have done a really good job for the state of Oregon. I think you've been leaders in this area. You do more with less than what we see in the market. And I think it is a moment of complexity. So the work that your staff is doing and you're doing to think on the long term is going to pay off, because you do have treasury, you do have long-term liabilities the work that we all do to drive returns is critical to the social impact of what we're doing also.
Jim, I'm remiss. I didn't realize there was a question from Patty.
Yes, I just have a question, and I'm not sure if I'm going to articulate this well, but as you think about the future and the challenges with competing dollars for infrastructure, the movement toward decarbonation and inflation, how should we think about those trends as we're looking to build our portfolio for the future?
Yeah, the way I would look at it is identify problems that needed to be solved, that the world will solve, and try to put capital in a place that solves them. And what I see happening in the world is capital is beginning to focus on some problems. The problem of the last 30 years was this kind of, it was almost like the opportunity of digitization became like, you know, Facebook was going to have its own currency and, you know, the government wasn't going to mind. And so there was this kind of sense of like, you know, grab the fruit. But in fact, as I look ahead, I think the world is realizing you need to redo your infrastructure, you need to deal with climate, we need to deal with social inequality. And that's why solving problems with capital in the long term, is, I think you will be paid. So in the short term, you can always, you know, short or go long GameStop. In the long term, you know, what are the big themes that you're trying to play out? Now, one of the themes over the last 20 years was interest rates were going down. And we know that, you know, we had Ben Bernanke recently, and someone asked me, what do you think about zero interest rates? And he says, well, zero is just a number. But my response to him was, so is 32 degrees Fahrenheit, but things happen at 32 degrees Fahrenheit, right? And so as we get to zero interest rate, like, things are changing. But so we can't go down forever, which means that going forward, capital is going to have to kind of do different things. And I would personally, because I think it's not only a smart thing to do, I think it's the right thing to do, is identify problems that you think are going to be addressed and see if you can find profitable ways to address those problems for the good of your beneficiaries and for society.
Well, Jim, once again, thank you. We're very grateful for your time, and we hang on every word.
Well, thank you, and we really appreciate the relationship. I can't say how important you've all been to us, and we look forward to continuing to build in the future.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So, Mike Langdon, as Jim said, we're doing very well with very few people. I think the reason is we have top quality people. So you're on.
Okay. Well, thank you for that intro. I just want to check first. Can everyone hear me okay?
Yes.
Perfect. Perfect. So for the record, Mike Langdon, I am on the investment team focused on the private markets here at Treasury, and it's my great pleasure and honor to represent our private equity team specifically today as we walk through the OPERF Private Equity Annual Review and 2021 Plan. Today I'll be joined in this presentation by a group of very important people to our approach. Tom Martin, first and foremost, will be representing the OIC's private equity consultant, Axia. Tom, as many of you know, has been in and around this portfolio for many, many years, so brings great historical context to these conversations. Likewise, we'll be hearing from a group of representatives from Pathway Capital. Pathway is one of our managers, but they play more of a strategic discretionary solutions provider role for us, adding to our implementations in a way that our staff would be challenged to do. Specifically, you'll be hearing from Karen Jacoby, one of the firm's founders and senior managing directors. Karen has been around the OPERF portfolio now for 2 decades, and candidly, she brings unmatched experience and perspective about the private equity industry. Derek Ransford will be joining us. Derek runs the co-investment practice at Pathway, and he is the person we interface with on an almost daily basis, or at least a weekly basis, as we look to support Pathway's management of our co-investment program. And then finally, Pete Verovanich runs the firm's secondary practice, and he is the individual we work most closely with on the enhanced monitoring and liquidity management program. Again, and we'll talk more in more detail on all of those in the coming pages. I'll ask all of our speakers in this virtual format, please be very careful to identify yourself as we pass this presentation back and forth, because I can imagine it will be challenging to track who's doing the talking. And I would also acknowledge that last year we used this as an opportunity for the OIC to get more exposure to Treasury's full private equity team. We felt in a virtual format and with five presenters already that didn't make sense today. But it's fair to say that they deserve a lot of the credit for any of the good we're about to talk about. And you can please feel free to continue to allocate any of the blame for anything you don't like here today to me. Hopefully, and I'd imagine it is the case, that the presentation we just heard from Jim Coulter gave you a good sense from the manager's perspective, from a bottoms-up perspective, the type of evolution that needs to occur, the type of refinement of tools and capabilities that needs to come to bear to make the level of returns that we're asking our managers to create. What we'll hope to do here in the next 45 minutes or so is give you the other side of that story, our side of the story as a limited partner from a top-down basis, how we've tried to evolve our toolkit, again, facing that same very challenge of generating returns in a more competitive and complex world. We are not, by any stretch of the imagination, naive to that challenge, and we understand some of the very real and important questions you will have. So those of you who've heard this presentation in the past will know that this tends to be among the more interactive sessions on the OIC's calendar. Again, it's a virtual session, so I know that'll be challenging. We will do our best to make room for your questions, but please feel free to direct us as you see fit, and don't be shy about interrupting along the way. In terms of what we're going to talk about, this is an honest conversation about the where have we been, where are we today, and where are we going. So we'll start by giving you some level-setting slides, just talking about how the allocation fits from a policy and belief standpoint, how we measure success, and a snapshot of our current exposures. We'll then move into what we spent time on in the last year. We'll move into from there how we've evolved the implementation, talk about return attribution. You'll then get some time to talk to Pathway, which I think is hugely important, and then we'll finish by talking about what we're going to do going forward. So in terms of our agenda, and this is a busy slide you see in front of us, in front of you, obviously, what we're trying to do here is tie this agenda back to your investment beliefs. So all the small print on this page is the OIC's investment beliefs. There's no new information there. And you will be probably not surprised to learn that the investment belief that matters most to this presentation when we're talking about private equity is number four, which is that private market investments can add significant value and represent a core OIC OST competency. So that is the foundational belief that underpins everything we're about to talk about today. In terms of the strategic role of the portfolio, a lot of words on this page coming from beliefs and policy. Let me cut through all that for you and put simply, the role is very clear. The private equity portfolio, as articulated in policy, is to produce excess return as compared to what can be achieved by investing simply through public equities. Very clear in policy about that. Specifically, we are meant to generate returns of at least 3% per annum above what can be achieved in the public markets. And for benchmarking purposes, we proxy the public markets using the Russell 3000. So again, couldn't be more clear what the role of this portfolio is and how we measure success against that objective. At the bottom of this page, yep, please.
Well, while you're on this page, is the implication of this that we may not have the correct benchmark?
Chair Russell, you will recall many conversations on this topic, and we come prepared to talk about it again today. So what you see on this page, if I'm sitting in your seat, what do I see? I see a private equity portfolio that on an absolute basis has generated very compelling returns. But what I also see is over the 5 and 10 year period, a portfolio that has drastically underperformed the policy benchmark, which is the Russell 3000 plus 3%. And I think there's a very fair conversation to be had about the 10-year period we're looking at, 5 and 10 year period we're looking at, particularly when you think about the massive run-up in a handful of very large companies, U.S.-based companies, what that has done to a domestic-only index like the Russell 3000. But that's not what I see when I see these numbers. And I'm not trying to discount, you know, the valid point that was just made. I'm not trying to avoid that question. But as we'll come on to in the rest of the presentation, as challenging as it would have been to hit a 17% compounding return over the last decade, it is my belief that there are some identifiable execution issues, not to be second-guessing history, but there were some execution decisions that weren't perfect. And more importantly, there was some implementation capability that was not available to the OIC and OST. And in my view, and we'll talk about it in the coming pages, had we had some of those tools, the tools that we have today, as big of a challenge as 17% is, and I'm not saying we definitely would have hit 17% over a decade, I think we would have been a lot closer to it. I don't think you'd be seeing 400 basis points today. So to me, and admittedly I'm a competitive person from this perspective, I look at this page and I think about how we can generate a paradigm where we're going to be much, much more competitive on a relative return basis going forward. I don't see an urgency to change the benchmark myself, but that's a fair debate to be had. What we have done on this page, just to be very clear, is we've shown you the Russell 3000 plus 3%. That's what matters. That is the policy benchmark. We've also shown you the MSCI ACWI plus 3%, really to give you a sense of how we performed relative to global equities, global public equities, not simply domestic equities. And taken together, those give you a clear sense of whether we're hitting our primary objective, which would be generating significant excess return relative to the public markets. Our portfolio, and we'll talk about it on the next page, is probably halfway between the two in terms of regional exposures. But again, that gives you a clear sense of how we've done against that primary objective. The last number on the page, the Burgess All Funds X Real Assets, that's a measure of the private equity market itself. So now we're comparing our implementation and our execution against effectively the index, if you want to think about it that way. So there we answer the question, were there different decisions we could have made, better decisions we could have made that would have led to a different outcome? You know, I would tell you that, you know, our results clearly look better relative to the global public equities index. I think our execution was fine relative to the asset class. In both cases, I think we could do better, and really it wasn't a question of certain implementation issues. It was a question of capabilities that we probably didn't have. But I recognize what these numbers look like. I recognize how important this page is. We're only on page 3, but here is where we need to stop and ask if there's further questions and areas for discussion.
Well, I have a further comment, actually, Mike. If the comparison is to the public equity market, if our public equity in OPRS was entirely domestic, then I think that benchmark is appropriate, but that's not the case. We have global investments in the public market, and to me, the benchmark should reflect the comparison to our own public market investments. Yeah. This is not to be decided today. But
yeah, no, and I think as we talked about in the past, that is very fair. Tom Martin and I, you might recall a year or two ago, gave a presentation on the top of benchmarking and in the private markets, as the message of that presentation was, there are no good answers to this question. So we should engage in that conversation again. But what I would leave you with today, not to avoid the question, is I spend all of my time thinking about how do we get the 3%. I don't spend a lot of my time thinking about the proxy that's applied against. So I'm sorry, I believe we were about to get a question from Vice Chair Samples, so let me pause again and ask for that.
Yeah, thank you for that. John, I had this conversation with Michael, was it last week, 2 weeks ago, asked him a very similar question, so we're thinking along the same lines here. And I totally hear you, Michael. We've talked in depth about kind of the missteps with the timing, as well as the fact that the public market's performance is potentially out of whack, at least on the one-year time frame. But if we look at how we're doing relative to the industry overall, the Burgess All Funds, we're doing decent Now, I hear you. We can do better. We ought to outperform given our capabilities, but we are doing decent relative to the industry, which also begs the question, you know, if this is how the total private equity world is performing, what ought our target or benchmark be? And I also know and understand that there is a difference between the two, right? One thing is to benchmark yourself, and another thing is what you expect the long-term returns to be, because that number is what will drive our asset allocation decisions, at least on a risk-adjusted basis, right? So I do want to delineate the two. One is sort of, let's benchmark our performance. The other is, if this is the number we're using to set our long-term return expectations and to set our asset allocation policies, and it's out of whack, then that is another issue.
Yes, and not to take us down the benchmarking rabbit hole, but and I'm happy to give you each that presentation again on an individual basis, because I think it is a useful exercise. That last piece that you came to, how do you think about benchmarking in the context of the forward outlook, capital market assumptions, the numbers you assume in those models? That's the crux of why it's so hard. That's why this concept of public markets plus a premium has always kind of made a sense, because you could calculate that number and put it in the model. It's challenging to make a projection on what the Burgess is going to do, but we've already got a sense of what we think public equities are going to do, so we then apply a premium to that in our models. It is by no means a perfect proxy for what we're trying to do, but it does measure, as expressed in policy, are we hitting our objective? I mean, the policy is very clear. So I think it, you know, I'm not trying to cut off that debate. You need to consider the role of the portfolio and how it's expressed in policy, and that answers the question of, you know, what is the perfect benchmark and how do we translate that into a set of capital market assumptions. It's five conversations rolled into one with a series of trade-offs.
Well, Mike, that's the first page.
Yeah. But it's important. And again,
good luck.
the numbers you see here today, you know, carry them with you for the rest of the presentation. We're going to be talking about implementation and historical return attribution and capabilities. And I don't want to say it's in response to these numbers, because it's really about what we need to do going forward, but it's instructive to how these numbers historically have looked like they have. So let me move forward quickly to our exposures. Here we're just trying to give you a snapshot of what we have in the portfolio today, so you can get a sense for what our exposures are. I did pull in some more language from policy, because the secondary objective of our portfolio is diversification. But if you look at this language, it's really speaking more to the value of diversification within the private equity portfolio. It's not articulating that private equity is a diversifier in our broader asset allocation. I would argue myself, for reasons that Jim Coulter did a good job of outlining, that increasingly the two markets are very different in terms of the addressable universe, and we see that expressed in subsector exposures and at times geographic exposures that are wildly divergent between the two. So increasingly there likely is a value in diversification, but as we sit here today, we're really talking about the benefit of diversifying within private equity. So real quickly, here we're showing our time diversification in terms of our deal level vintage exposure. That picture to me looks good, not perfect. Would like to see less exposure to some of those older vintage deals, and we're working on changing that going forward. On strategy, we're a bit index-like, which is not surprising given our scale. It is challenging for us to make a big bet on small managers, venture, things of that nature. Geography, we've added some exposure, some commitments in the area of Western Europe, and I would expect in the future you'll see that tick up at the expense of North America. And again, we still there face a bit of that scale challenge. It would be challenging, if not unadvisable, for us to make a big push into the emerging markets at our size. And then lastly, in terms of sector exposure, I think what you'll see here, and apologies for the tiny typeface, what this picture is probably telling you is that private equity in the OPERF portfolio kind of gives us very similar sector exposures to what you would get if you invested in the Russell 3000 or MSCI ACWI. But again, I would say what's happening underneath these numbers is very different. The types of financial services companies that we invest in, as an example, look nothing like the financial services companies you get exposure to when you invest in the Russell 3000. So again, those are really level setting slides. And let me pause before we actually start in on the meat of the presentation. So if there's no question, sorry.
Go ahead.
So I'll try and pick up the pace here because I want to let you hear from our other speakers a bit. We always sort of start this with an executive summary. So very quickly, here's the three takeaways that we're going to want to leave you with today. First and foremost, performance, and we've already talked about it. While strong absolute is more challenging on a relative basis as we look at the 5- and 10-year numbers, current exposure, which we'll come on to in a second, we currently represent about 24% of the pension. We're meant to represent less than 22%. We've taken some action already. We have medium-term solutions, and we'll talk a bit about that. And then most importantly, we want to give you a sense that we have a plan. We've revised our implementation to respond to the modern world, and we think we have the tools that we need to be competitive and deliver against our objectives going forward. So with that, I'm going to turn it over to Tom Martin, again representing AXIA, to make a couple comments on the investment environment.
Hello, everybody. Tom Martin from AXIA. Pleasure to be with you virtually. I am not in a shady motel. Some of the kinks of the virtual world mean that you don't always have control of the things you have control of. So my Stanley Hotel virtual background got stuck, and I was unable to change it. But this has been my theme for the COVID period, being trapped in the Stanley Hotel from The Shining. So I'm really in the corner of my bedroom like a lot of us are. So pleasure to be with you today. Whoever's driving the slides, if you roll to number 6, I think. Just a quick high-level review of sort of the investment environment. At 100,000 feet, despite the COVID pandemic and all the pervasive global suffering and implications of that, the private equity industry, I think, as a whole, performed relatively well over the course of the year. And navigating all of the unique challenges presented by the events that transpired. If you were to look at the year, it's sort of a tale of two periods. There was a shock to the system in the second quarter, and then a slow but steady recovery in the second half of the year, where we saw really all levels of activity accelerate from a stop to a increasing pace. It's amazing the way in which we have all pivoted into a virtual world. It's happened in all facets of life. I think the industry has, as a whole, has pivoted incredibly well and made that transition. And we've seen that with sort of the execution that started to happen in the back half of the year. If you compared last year to the year before, in aggregate, M&A activity lagged slightly. There was a slow first half of the year and a pretty rapid acceleration in the back half of the year. Prices, generally speaking, remained high. I think, there's still a very positive forward-looking growth assumption underlying the pricing environment today. Certainly, there are certain sectors where there's been compression, but, in aggregate, I think there's a healthy forward-looking outlook on growth. Sort of going to some of the things that Jim talked about in terms of the market share of private equity. Private equity remains a very material percentage of the M&A market, and we expect that to continue to pervade. Leveraged finance, if you were to look at it in general, from a holistic perspective, was relatively stable despite all of the volatility in underlying sectors of the economy. There was a cycle of sort of waivers and amendments that came through capital structures. But overall, I think it you could look at it and say, despite that, it remained relatively stable for the year. The M&A activity was really split between new platform acquisitions through the LBO, traditional LBO financing market, and then a lot of add-on acquisitions that were being done in the back half of the year to support platform expansion. Technology and IT is a very dominant theme throughout the industry. I think we expect that to continue for the foreseeable future. The consumer retail sector was obviously hit the hardest, where we've seen, you know, some restructurings and pain points in portfolios that are going to linger for a while. Overall, the returns for the industry were reasonably robust for the year despite all of this. And then fundraising was, you know, while down year over year, just in the context of COVID, was actually surprisingly active. And not only active, but competitive. And so the same issues that we've talked about in the past about, you know, access constraints to high conviction managers are still there. We've seen, you know, the treadmill of the fundraising cycle continues to accelerate, where GPs are deploying capital in shorter time frames and coming back to market sooner. That's where the relationships that, you know, we talk about developing become so important in order to facilitate that access. Exit activity, you know, was sluggish for the first couple quarters of the year, and then the fourth quarter really opened up. We saw the IPO market open. A lot of private companies were making their way through to the public markets. You know, we've seen recently as well sort of the advent of the SPAC. That's become a very active market environment. We could have a whole separate conversation related to that. But we did see sort of exits start to come through the portfolio. And so what was a pretty sluggish exit, and then the material part of that is distributions coming back to you from the portfolio, was very slow in the first part of the year, started to accelerate in the back half. And, you know, there's some positive momentum there for the time being as well. I think it's clear to say, you know, the industry has survived sort of the first order impact of COVID. If you look at sort of March until today, I think it's true in all facets of our life, but it's very unclear, I think, what sort of the second and third order impacts are. And so there are still lingering pain points in certain industries, in certain portfolio companies that, you know, we're just going to have to wait and see how vaccine deployment goes, the implications on growth, the government policy response, and how all of those things come together and impact forward-looking growth within certain industries. And we just don't know today. So it's been, you know, an interesting part of the cycle to live through. And we feel good about how the portfolio has held up. I think we still have some uncertainty, but a pretty good foundation in place based on what's happened over the last year to think about sort of the future going forward. So with that, I'll pass it back to Mike.
Thank you, Tom. Before I pick it up again, I want to check, are there any questions that Tom and I can address on environment? Okay, hearing none. If we can move to slide 7, and I'll go really fast through this one. Every year we present to you at the end of this presentation, we'll do the same today, you sort of a list of 5 priorities that staff will be undertaking and focusing on in the coming year. And we always come back to you the next year and do a bit of a self-scoring exercise. Normally I'd walk you through all of this, but if I'm being perfectly honest with you, I think we all know that at the end of February, this plan went completely out the window. So the bigger message I want to leave you with is very, very proud and grateful about the way everyone stepped up to that challenge. Our team did an unbelievable job. Their productivity, professionalism, effectiveness was every bit as good last year as it would have been in 2018 or 2019. The demands we put on our legal team, our operations team, were the same as always, and they met the challenge. Obviously, IT kept us functional. The OIC didn't miss a beat. The PEC didn't miss a beat. Torrey Cove did everything we asked them to. Managers like Pathway, the same. So I can talk to any of these bullet points you want me to, but the more important message is very grateful for how everyone executed in a very challenging year. So if there's no questions, I'm going to actually turn it right back over to Tom, and he's going to finish off the review of the year that was.
The year that was, I won't spend a ton of time on this either, other than to say we sort of said we set the goalpost for the last several years at $2.5 to $3.5 billion of annual capital commitments. We were really close to the bogey that Mike is desperate to hit, you know, every year, like right on point, including the decimals. So we were close, and I know he's not happy, but, you know, we're within the goalpost, I think. So we did what we said we were going to do in terms of how we presented last year. In terms of the underlying decisions that were made, the only, you know, geographically it looks probably like the general framework we're trying to build within the portfolio. No outliers there. I'd say from, if you look at the underlying strategies, there's, you know, there's more growth in VC that was done last year. I think there's two reasons for that. The particular venture relationships that we have exposure to tend to raise capital on a very similar cycle, so they are typically clustered together. And then separately, for a number of years now, there, and it will continue in the future, there is a strategic initiative going on to expand the growth equity exposure in the portfolio. And so you're likely to see some more growth names come through the annual pipelines. But, you know, the headline here is we were on plan, on target, executed despite all of the challenges we had, basically in line with what we represented we were going to do at the beginning of last year.
Tom, I have to ask this question because in that list is a $30 million investment. And I've always been intrigued by venture capital. I use it for my own funds. But when I talked to Sherbrum about it years ago, he said, well, the problem is that they're all small. Is this early stage or the USV 2021, $30 million, is that an example of that?
So that is a unique relationship, I would say, within the context of the total portfolio. That is a very high-quality venture relationship that Oregon has been involved with since its inception. The size of that capital commitment represents a meaningful percentage of their capital raise for the opportunities presented here. And I think it is the fact that we have continued to support that relationship is indicative of, you know, A, they've performed exceptionally well. They have a very unique perspective on the market and have done a very good job executing their strategy. And it also reflects the fact that while venture is a challenge and will continue to be a challenge within the context of the portfolio, we aren't ruling it out. We haven't closed the door. We have an opportunistic, flexible approach. There will come venture opportunities that are a fit for this portfolio. And I think it's important to sustain, you know, OPERF's activity in the venture market to make sure those doors can be opened in the future. So while we've scaled down the number of relationships, we do have a few core relationships that we will very likely continue to support. And it's certainly possible that that could grow over time. But it would be very difficult to suggest that over the next several years we're going to build out a 10% allocation to venture, for example. I think we view it as a zero target exposure where we're opportunistically adding things that make sense from a broader perspective.
Good. Thanks. I endorse that. That's fine.
Okay, so let's roll over to the next slide. Okay, so for the year, you had contributions of $3.4 billion and distributions of $3.8 billion. There was an acceleration of capital calls in the spring, as I think we've talked about before. A lot of the underlying managers have lines of credit. There was a movement industry-wide to get those lines paid down to create flexibility in the midst of a very uncertain economic environment. So we had some capital call activity related to that. The distributions last year are slightly different. There was the component of the distribution that came through regular, ordinary course, exits, either sales or IPOs, et cetera, refinancings. But there was a component introduced last year through the Enhanced Monitoring and Liquidity Program where there was a supplement to that distribution triggered by that program where we were bringing forward future cash flows, and that got rolled into the distribution number for last year. And then finally, there's 17.5% target for the portfolio plus 4% to get to the top end of the range. We are still over that number. I think that is a challenge that we have talked about for a number of years. I think importantly, we believe, to use Jim's analogy, that we now have the sharper tools in the toolbox to now manage that in a more active way when appropriate, and the Enhanced Liquidity Management Program and what was executed last year is the beginning of that. You will see later when we talk about pacing, we are trying to build a core sustainable alpha generating portfolio that can be dialed up or dialed down without breaking the fundamental underlying components. And so over the last several years with the broader new implementation program, getting those foundational pieces in place has been critical, and the council's support for the flexibility to allow us to do that has been really critical. And now those tools are in place, and I think we can more actively manage around that sort of headline number without breaking the portfolio. And I'll pause there if there are any questions on that topic.
I guess I do have one, and I'm not sure whether it's more appropriate now, or I think one of you said we're going to hear from Pathway at a later point, recognizing there's a lot of details that probably aren't worth talking about in this setting. I wonder, at the right time, if you can share sort of the lessons from this early experience with the enhanced liquidity management and what we should expect about that going forward.
Sure. So this is, again, Mike Langdon from Treasury staff. Why don't we pause for a second on that? And we'd love to, when we turn it over to Pathway, certainly Derek will be able to give you some perspective on how we're working with them on the co-invest program, and Pete will be able to give you the answer to the question, which is an important one.
Great. Thanks.
So, Tom, I'll pick it up from here. If we could flip over to slide 10, please. The next couple of slides are really going to talk through how we've revised our approach to, again, use the terminology that Jim Coulter used, how we've evolved and sharpened our tools, in effect. And hopefully you'll hear a lot of the same themes. I got to be honest with you, that was not intentional. It's fortunate, but it's not intentional. But to give you a sense of the history, and I think it's important, so please bear with me. I don't want to use our valuable time going through too much history, but really the OIC deserves credit back 5 or 6 years ago in identifying the fact that, or the reality that, in a world where more and more capital is coming into the private markets, where the world is getting more and more competitive, more and more transparent, more and more efficient, it was candidly going to become increasingly hard for our managers and for us to generate those high levels of return that we're looking for here. And as a consequence, they asked staff and they asked Axia, their consultant, to develop a new framework to give us the best position to be competitive, so a modernized implementation. And we attacked that problem by trying to answer three fundamental questions. First and foremost, how do we create and maintain exposure at scale to this asset class? And at scale to us is north of $15 billion, so not a small number. That's actually more of a challenging issue than you might otherwise think because of the life cycle of these investments we're making. We need to feed the machine on a serial basis with new commitments. Those commitments translate into capital calls to make investments, and when the investments are realized, we get the money back. So we're chasing a target consistently. Secondly, making it increasingly complex, it's not just a passive exercise. We're not simply trying to create that exposure for the sake of diversification. We have very clear objectives and policy about excess returns. So we need to create and maintain the exposure, and it has to hit a high bar in terms of the returns that it generates. And lastly, specific to us, we need to do all that in a manner that works for OPERF, the OIC, OST. So the plan needs to capture all of our strengths and weaknesses, all of our limitations. It needs to consider the resources we have today and we'll have in the future. Consider the governance model, the legal model, the stakeholder engagement. All of that needs to be factored into our reorientation around how we're approaching this asset class. How did we attack this problem? First, I would tell you that what we had been doing, and again, this is something that'll sound familiar from what Jim Coulter said, we'd pursued up until about 2015 what I would characterize as the endowment implementation model. And that model really focuses exclusively on manager selection, thinking if you back the right managers, nothing else matters. They'll produce the right results. That works and did work for us for a very long period of time, but it relies very much on access and access to the right types of managers. Increasingly, as this asset class has grown up around us, our scale was becoming more and more problematic. The other model that is out there is the Canadian model, named because it was pioneered by a set of large Canadian pension plans. Also, as Jim Coulter would have told us earlier, it's effectively used by the world's best sovereign wealth funds like those in Singapore. That's a model that goes beyond manager selection and tries to bring into play more dynamic implementation capabilities. And in doing so, it turns scale from a disadvantage to an advantage. So you could probably understand why that was a useful thing for us to look at. It was very useful if we think about existential question number two on this page is how do you make the returns at scale? We were able to pull apart the different things they were doing and have a conversation about what elements of that can we do in a different way. More challenging when we think about question number one, candidly, because we have a portfolio and a plan of a maturity and a cash flow profile that looks completely different from a Canadian pension plan or a sovereign wealth fund. So different challenge for us. We had to think about that one differently. And most importantly, I'm sure it's obvious that we were never going to assume that we'd be in a position to bring the structure along of a large sovereign wealth fund. We were never going to be able to replicate the resources, the discretion, any of those things. So that was the biggest piece of the problem solving. What are we trying to accomplish? But more importantly, how do we accomplish it in a way that works for us? So if we flip forward to page 11, we built a plan, and you've seen this before, but we built a plan that has three foundational principles, and I'll go on to a little bit more detail in what each of these mean in a moment. But for starters, we have a focused primary program. That is the manager selection fund investing piece of what we do. So were we still pursuing the endowment model exclusively, that would be the only thing on this page. But because we are not, we have to move on to principles two and three, a heavy focus on fee mitigation to keep more of the gross returns our managers are generating for ourselves. And lastly, a commitment to smooth pacing to try and better comply with our target allocation going forward, and maybe just as importantly, to try and avoid unintentional market timing going forward. So let me, again, try and pick it up a bit. We'll move to page 12, just ticking through the pillars of the plan. Our refocused primary program, what have we done here? Well, in a complex world, we have actually halved the number of manager relationships that we work with. Historically, we would have worked with 60 or 80. Today, we're working with 40 or 45. The reason for that is very clear. Our managers are more complex than they've ever been. The deals they are doing are more complex than they have ever been. And the expectation that our team is on top of every portfolio company is higher than it's ever been. You put all of that together and you look at the size of our team and you can see how realistically 40 to 45 managers is all we should be overseeing. You layer on to that, I can't even describe to you how much time this team spends on ad hoc advisory board calls on a weekly basis with these managers. So we're real time working through complex issues with this small group of managers. In doing this, we had to completely update all of our prospecting due diligence and monitoring processes. And we did so with an eye towards a lot of what Jim Coulter was talking about this morning. We want a fundamental understanding of how our managers are evolving and the tools they're bringing to bear to generate sustainable returns in the long term. And candidly, we're hyper-focused on earnings growth. That's going to be the lever they're going to have to pull. How they get at that can mean different things, but that's the lever we're focused on. You heard, again, one version of what that looks like from Jim Coulter in terms of how they've evolved their toolkit, but rest assured, a version of that conversation is going on with every manager that we either currently invest with or would be considering in the future. One thing to note before we move off this is that over the last year, in response to the OIC's renewed expression within the investment beliefs of the values of ESG and diversity and inclusion, we have more formally over the last year structured how that fits into our underwriting and monitoring processes. We're fortunate to have a group of professionals working across the private markets and with the help of Risk as well, who led that work, and we've come up with a framework that better captures those issues in our due diligence process. As you can imagine, it's a process, when we're measuring any issues, this is a process that focuses on long-term iterative conversations with the manager. We're trying to get a sense of how they make decisions, who we're partnering with, and how those decisions have long-term impacts. So this was a natural way to integrate that into our existing framework. But again, a big thank you goes to our ESG champions for really helping us up our game in that area. There are consequences, obviously, to pursuing a focused fund investing program and a smaller manager roster. Obviously, we're putting more money behind fewer managers. That means we need to be very, very careful about how they all sum up to a set of exposures and we get the right, return factors in our portfolio. Further, we need to acknowledge that we've largely migrated out of the small cap space and made it challenging for us to do things like venture. There are very good returns in those areas, but over the last several years, candidly, we've been most focused on sort of these big picture top-down solutions, so we've sort of consciously de-emphasized those areas, at least temporarily. And lastly, as a consequence of that, I should say, it puts a big burden on us to focus heavily on fee mitigation. It puts a big burden on us to focus on our pacing discipline.
Isn't it true that venture funds have just gotten a lot bigger over the last few years? Like Sequoia's latest fund is, I don't even know how big, but
yeah, there's almost a new asset class that has been born at the intersection of traditional growth equity and late-stage venture. There's super late-stage venture, if you like. And the Sequoias of the world have obviously moved into that world, raising multi-billion dollar funds to do very late-stage investments. And the strategy there, doesn't necessarily end at IPO. They might continue to hold those businesses as they're public. You have a couple of new entrants that I'm sure we've all heard of, the Tiger Globals, the Dragonese, the Coatues. As Tom said, even though we haven't focused a ton of energy on venture, we've spent a lot of time thinking about, how we can get more growth exposure, and those strategies have been very much part of that discussion. So we've met with all those managers, spent time with all those managers. I think there's an opportunity to put scale capital behind that strategy. It hasn't gotten across the line for us yet, but it's still certainly under consideration. You see an interesting phenomenon playing out in the market today. It was private for longer for the last decade. There was, a big push for companies to be 10, 15 years in the private markets before they ever went public. It'll be interesting to see what happens going forward, because the public bid in terms of the IPO couldn't be stronger. It's stronger than it's ever been. I don't think it reverses that trend permanently, but it's certainly a shift away from the norm, which will have a big impact on those strategies.
And then how do you think about when you get less managers and you say the funds have to be – the less managers means bigger funds, and how do you think about – like the innovation and the diversity, equity, inclusion factors of selecting managers?
There's no running from the fact that it's harder to do both of those things. One thing I would say is, no question, it's challenging to do small managers. It's challenging to do venture managers. We have been committed to not using this process to mean that we're only doing mega funds. In fact, if you actually look at the types of exposures we have today, I think we've actually pulled the center of gravity down to the upper middle market buyout space. That is our core market today, and we think there's still very attractive returns to be had there. The innovation piece is the interesting one. Not to tip my hand and get people too excited at some New York and San Francisco based GPs, but you think about what Jim Coulter said earlier, how some of that can come in collaboration with your bigger relationships. That may be a way to thread the needle in those areas. But we are, just to make it clear, we have an open door policy. We've gone to point solutions, geographic solutions, ways to get at growth equity exposure in different geographies. We're happy to be creative and figure out how we get the set of exposures that we want here.
Thanks.
Great. Again, our second objective, acknowledging that we've self-selected into the upper middle market predominantly, is that the world will not stop becoming more competitive and more efficient. We know definitively, in our view, that high levels of gross return are not going to be easy to come by. We need to bend the curve in our favor by reducing that massive gross to net spread associated with simply investing in funds. The way we've gone about that is really twofold. And to be honest with you, the challenge for us is always how to implement. We knew what we needed to do, but we needed to come up with a structure that works within our paradigm. So we started with a set of one-off negotiated discounts or structured discounts with our managers. We then introduced our co-investment program with Pathway, and Derek is going to give some comments on that in a few minutes. But from my perspective, that's the key lever we'll pull here going forward. I'm very pleased at how it has gone in the early days. It's scaled very nicely. We've got enough deal flow to execute the strategy, and we're approaching it in a way that we can confidently tell you that we can generate the types of savings that we need to year in, year out here without massively changing the game in terms of execution risk, concentration risk, a lot of the things that you would associate with co-investing historically. So I'll leave it to Derek in a few minutes to give a few comments on that. But again, that's the lever we're pulling on here, and we're very pleased so far in how that is going. Let me, if there are no questions, pull forward to pacing. And this is the one, as Tom has kind of alluded to, I get a little bit passionate and emotional about them. I have a belief that pacing is underappreciated as a return factor. And candidly, it is my belief that pacing is the story of our 5- and 10-year returns. So it can be every bit as important as manager selection. I think most people focus on manager selection. Quite rightly, it's massively important. But if you get the pacing wrong, you can blow any good decisions you made from a manager's perspective. Pacing matters for two primary reasons. First and foremost, every investment we make has its own life cycle. When you commit to a fund in the early years, you're in the J-curve period as it's just getting going and you have weak returns. The end of the fund's life, you're in the runoff period, selling those last few investments, dealing with end-of-life issues. Again, there are weak returns there. All the very high-quality returns that we want exist in years 2 and 3 through 7 and 8. And smooth pacing allows us to create a balanced portfolio where the predominance of our exposure over time is in the fat part of that return curve. So that's the objective there. If you are accelerating your pacing, putting more and more capital to work in the asset class, you are intentionally or unintentionally overweighting yourself to the J curve. Likewise, if you're slowing your pacing, you're overweighting yourself to the runoff period.
Do you see that funds are, is there a trend around hold periods for private equity funds in terms of how long they're holding the company? So you said year 2 to year 7. Is that been consistent over time, and do you think that's staying consistent going forward?
It's an excellent question, and I can give five answers to it. So there's a couple of clear things that have happened that have played out in the numbers. First and foremost, all the investments we made going into the financial crisis, they held those a lot longer for reasons that should be obvious. So that's been problematic. Secondarily, as we make commitments in the years since the global financial crisis, the investment pace in terms of deployment has picked up. Usually we would have thought about a 3 to 4 year deployment cycle when we make a commitment. Now we're talking about a 2 or 3 year deployment cycle. That has had to play through the numbers. Lastly, there has been a trend and a desire to hold certain assets longer. There's actually been product development in this area. There are long-hold private equity funds, and we've spent a lot of time thinking about that as an interesting risk-return profile. Further, we have managers that want to double down on their winners, invest across funds. That's been the second leg of it. So we see managers buying a company from Fund A to Fund B. That introduces massive amounts of complexity. Perversely, in the last year, Tom mentioned all of a sudden there's been a pickup in distributions. The things that are getting sold are three and four years old. So all of a sudden, we're looking at the other end of the spectrum where our managers are opportunistically booking early gains where they can. So it's a bit of a mixed bag, but I would say less and less rigid adherence to the conventional 5-year hold on an underwriting basis, more and more thought to thinking about longer term holding periods. And I think that's something we're going to see continue. We might, frankly, see some stratification of this market like you would see in real estate, as an example. There might be a core version of private equity that has a fundamentally different return profile that might be interesting for our portfolio down the line. We have a lot of questions about that, but we're interested and we're having those conversations. Monica, I think you're on mute.
Sorry, do you think that affects your smooth pacing, or you just think smooth pacing in terms of vintage?
It's an absolute nightmare for our smooth pacing, to be perfectly honest with you. Every single one of those factors is tough to capture in a pacing model. And that's all of them add up, and there's more than that. I mean, there's the advent of subscription lines, which changed the actual timing of cash flows. All of that is tough to capture in a forward pacing model. So that is part of why that exercise has gotten so complex. But it doesn't change the fact that at the end of the day, there's a natural life cycle to this thing, and we want to make sure we're focused on the right part of the life cycle. The second part of it is very clearly there are good vintage years and bad vintage years, right? No doubt about it. So you have to be mindful that when you're making pacing decisions on a year-in-year out basis, you are expressing market timing, whether you mean to or not. And I would not propose that anyone try and proactively do this. We're doing this through lockup funds with long life cycles. You're just not going to get it right if you think you're going to time the market that way. So I say that you avoid that possibility altogether, try and neutralize the timing impact, and just make sure you're never in a position where you're over-allocated to the wrong vintage years, under-allocated to the right vintage years. The combination of these two factors, as Tom's going to talk about in a minute, is the story of our 5 and 10 year numbers. We've had a portfolio, if you look at the curve on the left side of this page, that is highly, highly focused, or was highly, highly focused in the runoff period of some of the investments we made, certainly more so than it should have been. Likewise, we were overexposed to the pre-crisis vintages, underexposed to the post-crisis vintages, and that, you know, we were on the wrong side of that from a market timing perspective. Last point I want to make on this page is, you know, obviously it's great to talk about smooth pacing, but how do you actually do it? First, you know, you try and be disciplined about the decisions you're making year in and year out. As Tom has already said, last 5 years we've fairly consistently found ourselves in that $2.5 to $3.5 billion pacing range. During that time frame, private equity fundraising had been rapidly expanding up and to the right. So fundraising activity was scaling. We were not chasing the market. We were staying steady as she goes and being consistent and deliberate about what we were doing. But that's, you know, discipline, it's hard to simply rely on discipline. So more recently, we have introduced the Enhanced Monitoring and Liquidity Management Program. And again, Pete Verovanich is going to speak to that in a few minutes. And what that allows us is to be more thoughtful about how we manage out our older investments, oversee and manage out those older investments.
Sorry, can I ask one last thing?
Of course.
You know, this guy, Jim Coulter, said that as private equity expands, it's a percentage of the total, like it's about market share. So do you think smooth pacing, like we have to, do you have to model it based on market share? Or...
The market share and the growth of equities in general drives the opportunity set. So that gives us more and more ways to think about what we do. But our pacing is mostly driven by growth in total plan assets. So we need to focus on, you know, what's the growth curve for OPERF? What's our target allocation? How do we pace to stay in that range?
Okay.
So let me actually pause there. I've given you a lot on our new implementation plan. Before I give it back to Tom to talk about a return attribution, let me ask if there's other questions we could address. Hearing none, Tom, please take it away.
All right, so continuing the return conversation, there are, you know, several other ways that we'd look at this from the perspective that there's no singular answer that unpacks all of the underlying issues. And so this is how we look at asset allocation and security selection. So think about the asset allocation as the decision to basically be in the market. The relevant reference point here would be the Russell and MSCI comparisons, and then the security selection being the for us, it's the manager selection and how we actually implement that participation. And that's referenced here by the Burgess quartile rankings. The key takeaway is this is the sort of same story we told before, and we've talked about it today. There was a period of time where there was an overallocation to bad vintage years, and that is expressed, in the red, obviously, which is bad here. I think that has informed a lot of lessons we continue to talk about. I think to the counterpart to that is to look at not only the more recent consistent pace of capital deployment, but a more stable return profile that looks interesting both on an absolute and a relative basis under the new implementation regime. All of these things are informed by the size, scale, constraints of the program. We talk a lot about the challenges. It's a double-edged sword. There are also a lot of opportunities that are created by the very nature of the program, whether it's unique relationships or fee mitigation driven by scale participation. So there's a balance there between the headwinds and challenges we have and the opportunities that are afforded by trying to build a program at scale. And so this is one way we've sort of unpacked it, looking at asset allocation and security selection and, two different relative reference points from a industry perspective and a public market perspective. Happy to answer any questions here, should there be any. Moving on to the what I referred to a number of years ago as our classic pig in the python problem, the legacy overallocation to pre-GFC vintage years created a weight on the program that an imbalance in the program that, because of the nature of those investments, has taken far longer than one would have expected at the initial time of that, those commitment decisions to work through the system. We have been challenged with this drag on the portfolio for a number of years now. It was the catalyst for the decision to proactively address it through the Enhanced Monitoring and Liquidity Program. And you can see sort of the progress made over the last several years where the portfolio looks more right-sized than where it should be in terms of vintage year exposure, and where we sit on, as Mike talked about, sort of that horizon curve of, you know, the J curve and the tail end, we sit, the portfolio's position more in the middle today than it has been, which is a much better place to be in terms of the underlying characteristics of the exposures. And then breaking it down into, you know, Jim talked about how wrong quartiles and cohorts and all the ways that the consultants look at these things. It, you know, we do the best that we can, and what we try to present every year and in conversation with you all are the same tools that we use to look at the portfolio from a number of different perspectives to get as much information as we can to help inform future decision making. So we do use quartiles, we do use PME analysis, we do break it down here into vintage year cohorts so we can isolate certain periods of time and see where there have been anomalies where we can figure out the key drivers of the anomaly and how that might inform something, action differently on a go-forward basis. Here, you know, you can see there's a cohort in the 05-08 pre-GFC vintage that has underperformed. As we've alluded to, that has been a drag on the program that is still sort of working its way through the system. As we look forward, you know, Toolbox has gotten better. You know, we've upgraded the toolkit, and I think that affords a lot more flexibility for us in terms of how we manage vintage year exposure post the initial commitment. The co-investment program allows flexibility around toggling up and toggling down on a tactical basis. And then obviously the enhanced monitoring liquidity program allows us to facilitate a backward-looking adjustment on vintage year exposure or even industry exposure should that evolve as an issue. So just another way that we unpack sort of the top-line returns and think about the impacts from a forward-looking portfolio construction perspective.
So I think here we're going to hand it over to the team from Pathway. I think first we're going to ask Karen Jacoby to make some comments.
Great. Well, thank you, Mike. Can everybody hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Okay, great. So good morning, and thank you, Chairman Russell and the council members, for having us present today to give you an update on Pathway and the assets that we manage for Oregon. As Mike said, I am Karen Jacoby, one of the co-founders of Pathway, and also presenting with me today will be Derek Ransford and Pete Verovanich, also both partners of the firm. So looking at the slide that we have up, this really provides you an overview of our firm. We are celebrating our 30th anniversary this year, having been founded in 1991, and I can say that time flies. It's hard for me to imagine that it's been 30 years since we were in a teeny tiny office up in Westwood and embarking on creating our firm. So we are 100% owned by our 21 partners and have a global team, as you can see on the map, spread across four offices. Today, we've got a deep and stable team with about 183 total staff, with 70 of those investment professionals focused solely on the private markets. That's all that we do. And further, our assets under management of about $65 billion makes us one of the largest private market managers in the world. If you want to flip to the next slide, this is an overview of our relationship with you. And as Mike mentioned earlier in his presentation, we do have a long relationship with you that dates back to 2001 when we created the first of two fund of funds focused on small sized funds, of one being $400 million and under and another $1 billion and under. But more recently, we've worked with you to help to find creative solutions to address the key areas of focus that, you know, you've talked about and reviewed today. And the first of those is the creation of a co-investment program in 2019. And, you know, Jim Coulter in his remarks mentioned the idea of managing the cost-quality trade-off. And importantly, with this program, you're able to maintain the quality, but yet do it at a lower cost because we're able to co-invest alongside your managers on a management fee and carry-free basis, thus resulting in fee mitigation overall. And, you know, this program is indeed off to what we believe to be a very strong start. And Derek's going to talk a little bit more about that in the next couple of slides. The second area of focus, again, along the lines of providing solutions for your program, was in terms of, you know, reducing the load of monitoring legacy funds for your staff, and then also to opportunistically seek liquidity from that portfolio so that we would have assets to redeploy a portion of those into your co-investment program. So at this point, I'll turn it over to Pete and Derek for the next couple of slides.
Good morning. My name is Pete Verivanich, and on here on slide 20, I'm pleased to report that you know, the Enhanced Monitoring and Managed Liquidity Program that Mike and Tom and Karen now have talked about earlier today, that we initiated in March of last year, I think, you know, has really started to provide the support and assistance to the staff to accomplish some of these long-term goals for the private equity program, both in terms of monitoring assistance and active liquidity assessment. So here on the page, you've got a summary of the program, both sort of prongs of what we're trying to do. On the enhanced monitoring side, I think it's important to note it's we have been able to act and participate on OPIR's behalf, on advisory boards, annual meetings, analyzing, executing some of these various legal administrative items that come up across a segment of the program. And as you may or could imagine, there's a significant portion of activity, particularly towards the end of the life of some of these funds, the end of their investment terms or just overall terms. And hopefully, as Mike and his staff can hopefully attest to here, that this enhanced monitoring support has provided them with some much needed relief with the day-to-day oversight of a good portion of this legacy portfolio that, you know, at a point in time, there were over 41 general partners that were being covered by Pathway to help Mike and the team out. And in addition to the enhanced monitoring support that we're providing, as we've been discussing, we are actively assessing liquidity opportunities for legacy portions of the portfolio. You know, really, as has been noted, the tool to really help out balance out the vintage year exposure, address this historical pacing issues. You know, Tom's pig in the python, I guess terminology here, and then. You know, really helping with that overall target private equity allocation that you have, and then also pulling forward proceeds and distributions that can be redeployed. As you can see here, you know, we oversee all aspects of the liquidity process, and then we'll also continue to monitor and assess future liquidity opportunities. You know, just as Tom mentioned, looking at vintage year exposures, looking at some of the duration of the underlying investments, and then also if there are other areas that make sense to help use this liquidity program to help manage the program. And you know, before I move on to having Derek talk about co-investments, I think, you know, I'll answer Treasurer Reed's earlier questions about lessons that we've learned so far with the liquidity program. And you know, really what we've seen and what we thought is, one, the secondary market has really continued to mature and has become an active and really natural part at this point of the private equity industry and environment. So just from a data point, last year or in 2020, over $60 billion in secondary purchases or secondary volume occurred last year, which was down slightly from $88 billion in 2019. But keep in mind that during, you know, the initial parts of the pandemic and the impact that it had on financial markets, it had a significant impact on secondaries. with the activity essentially being halted during, you know, call it the first and second quarters of this year. So despite really no activity happening in the first half of the year, there was still $60 billion in secondaries related volume. This is really due to a large capital overhang. Estimates right now are of about $177 billion in near-term available capital that's focused solely on secondary purchases of private equity assets. And we really expect that this capital overhang will continue to provide a really accommodating environment for Oregon as we continue to use this liquidity tool to accomplish, you know, some of these overall exposure goals. So what we really saw was going out to the market to see, you know, is there an appetite for some of these older assets? And what we saw was not only was there an appetite, but it was an extremely competitive dynamic with such a large amount of capital chasing these sorts of assets.
Pete, a quick question, if I may. It's John Russell. There's a line, overseeing the sale process managed by the secondary advisor. Are you all the secondary advisor, or do you hire that out?
No, we hired the secondary advisor. So what we'll manage is the RFP process, and then essentially work with the advisor through the marketing plan, going through and assessing first and second round bids, making sure that we're maximizing the outcome for Oregon.
What's an example of an advisor?
The large market advisors are groups like Evercore, Greenhill, Park Hill, Jefferies, Campbell Lutyens. Some of are some of the more high profile secondary advisors.
You know, John, this is Mike Langdon. The way I would characterize the nomenclature here is Pathway is the discretionary manager, and they will bring in outside advisory resources as they see fit to help do to make transactions, but it is their role to make the decisions.
If there's an example in the constructions, they're the contractor, not the sub.
Possibly. That's stretching my personal knowledge of real estate. I would think, you know, the same way if you were going to sell a building, John, you would hire an investment bank to help you do so. But make no mistake about it, John Russell is making the call about whether we're taking that bid.
Okay, thanks.
So if we may, we'll hand it over to Derek to speak about the co-invest program.
Great. Thank you all. Thank you for having us here to speak with you. My name is Derek Ransford. As Mike mentioned, I head the co-investment program along with one of my partners, and I'm pleased to report to you on the progress that we've made on building your co-investment program. The program commenced in January of 2019, and it followed several months, years, a discussion and thought on behalf of staff and Axia as we thought through the appropriate ways to implement a co-investment program in the current marketplace. And there was a real philosophical alignment and meeting of the minds between Pathway's approach to the marketplace and what was thought by both your staff and your consultant. First and foremost, the goal of this program, as we've talked about already today, is to reduce the economics associated with investing in private equity so that you can narrow the gross net spread and ultimately drive more net return to you and your underlying constituents. Philosophically, what we're trying to do, we call a systematic deployment of capital with a risk-based approach. What does that mean? That means we're focused exclusively on managers, first and foremost, in your program. So these are all GPs that your staff and your institution has invested in on a primary basis. For those underlying opportunities are in the funds you're in, and there are times where they need some more capital to transact and make those deals happen. And they are offering them to their limited partners on a no fee, not always, but usually a no fee and no carry basis. Systematically, it means that you're really looking at trying to deploy capital across a spectrum of deals rather than looking at a universe of opportunities and picking the one or two that you think are going to be the absolute best opportunities. It is more of a risk-based approach to avoid those that present excess risk that you're uncompensated for. So to build a bigger, broader, diversified portfolio while avoiding uncompensated risks. Again, I'm pleased to report that 100% of the deals that we've done to date have been from managers that are in your portfolio, and that's the absolute focus of the program. 100% of the deals we've completed to date are have no annual management fee and no carried interest, so those economic savings are being passed on to yourselves. And we've structured this program, which now has $1.1 billion of capital committed to it, such that it can be done in tranches, and that adds another tool for the staff to help manage the pacing. So tranches, capital can be added on an annual basis to execute on co-investments.
John Russell again. What's the motivation for the GP?
The motivation for the GP, and I think it ties back to what Jim Coulter was talking about, there's a couple. First and foremost, it is about relationships. And co-investments are typically offered to largest, longest LPs as a way to continue to cultivate that relationship. Also very much so as GPs have become more specialized and focused on particular industries and built up that industry expertise, when they see transactions that look attractive based on their networks and their experience, they want to be able to transact up and down size ranges within that area of expertise. And there are oftentimes where they'll find a deal that's very attractive that they want to put in the fund, but for their own fund concentration considerations, they don't have all the equity that they need. In the past, you know, pre-global financial crisis, there was a lot of clubbing up of GPs working together. It's a much cleaner governance situation where one GP can be in control. And so that has certainly increased the flow of co-investments up and down deal size ranges. So all these opportunities are typically going to be on the larger end for the particular GP. But because you have a number of GP relationships that focus around deal sizes, you can see on this page here on 21, you've got exposure to a wide variety of deal sizes.
Thank you.
Absolutely. The vehicle setup where Pathway has discretion, Pathway can utilize our 22-person co-investment team to diligence and negotiate and fund the underlying transactions and then monitor and report on those. It, however, does require a large amount of coordination between ourselves and your private equity staff, particularly on the front end, particularly on sourcing of transactions, where your staff can take advantage of the relationships and clearly the capital you deploy with those general partners to be instrumental in sourcing those transactions. And there are also situations where Pathway is also invested in the same managers that you're in, which we can collaborate in terms of effectively sourced transactions. That results in a lot of regular collaboration and interaction with ourselves and your investment staff, but allows us to institute a process and a timeliness with our team and with the resources we have to execute as your underlying GPs expect. It's a very deal-oriented, time-sensitive environment. And while your relationships get you into transactions and get you in favor, it's being able to execute on a process and on timelines that continues to get you invited into transactions. On the page here, you'll see that we've committed almost $700 million to 38 co-investments. It's across 19 general partners. It's actually since now gone up to 21. I mentioned no fee and no carry on any of the transactions. By taking advantage of the fee savings and passing on no fee and no carried interest, we believe it's been important to ensure that there's proper diversification. So we started off on a smaller scale, spreading capital around to a larger number of transactions to build yourself as a good counterparty to co-investments with these GPs and build diversification by deal size and industry and region. And then allow, as necessary, what those relationships establish, the ability to add more capital to transactions going forward. So it's early days for where we're at, but we're very excited about the program. It's been well received by your general partners and relationships, and the deal flow has been strong, and you know, performance while early is meeting expectations.
Mike Langdon, it's John Russell again. I still don't quite understand it. Let's say one of our big GPs offered us a co-investment. Would we use Pathway to carry that down to the finish line?
Yes, exactly right. So our staff is we own these GP relationships. The GPs come to us with everything. So whatever level of engagement they need from our staff to make sure that they feel comfortable that we know what's going on, we can help work through any allocation questions that come up, and most importantly, they're getting, you know, credit for showing the program deal flow. That's what they care about. They want to know that this is meaningful to us. If they show us deal flow, we value that. We recognize that. From there, to be very clear, though, the discretion lies with Pathway. And what we are getting beyond a lot of the things that Derek outlined here is frankly just the ability to execute. These are situations that move on an extremely fast timeline in certain cases. This is very frontline deal doing work. Derek, I don't know if off the top of your head, I mean, just how many NDAs did you guys execute last year associated with co-invest opportunities, something like that? You know, how quick do you have to turn around? Just that simple step one, what does that mean to you guys?
Yeah, we probably executed, across our entire program, well over 100 on behalf of your general partner relationships, at least 50. And it's not just one NDA. You also have to get access to the underlying consultant reports. And so there's usually 5 to 10 NDAs associated with each transaction. So yeah. I would multiply that by 5 to 10.
And you're looking to sort of turn those around in 24, 48 hours, right?
Usually 24 hours.
Yeah. So simple step, not a major step, but we got a really small team here. We've got limitations. We have to be very careful at the state of Oregon. Every bit of legal paper that we put our signature on has got to meet the minimum standards of the Department of Justice. If we were to try and do that for ourselves, not only do we not have the team to do it, the deal would be allocated and closed before we executed the NDA. So this is a way for us to execute in a market where it would otherwise be very challenging for us to execute.
Understood. Thanks.
Yeah. So before I move on, very grateful for Pathway spending the time with us this morning. They are an important part. They are a special type of relationship. As Jim Coulter was talking about this morning, innovating with big partnerships, this is not what he thought he was talking about, but I will tell you this is what he was talking about. And I understand how that looks. Good for you. You found a way to co-invest. Everyone's co-investing. But the innovation for us is in how we do it in a way that works for us. And the start of this process was a back and forth over a series of a year conversation with Pathway. What are you trying to accomplish? How are we approaching this? How can we figure out a way that works that supports your goal? Likewise with the liquidity program, same sort of thing. We have discrete challenges that are unique to us that we're trying to answer, and partnering with firms like Pathway allows us to innovate and answer some of those questions. So again, before I move off this slide, we have the team from Pathway. Are there any other questions that the OIC would like to direct from our team from Pathway? So hearing none, I'll ask if we can move to the next slide, and I'll go very quick because the rest of what we have here is just where are we spending our time on a roll-forward basis. Every year in this presentation, we like to give you a sense of the work we've done in collaboration with Axia on forward pacing, modeling, and things of that nature. Every year, we try and drive home the point that this is a tool that we use to have discussions about different scenarios. It is not as precise an exercise as it might look like on this page. We are trying to think through how to play with the different variables, how they change the picture going forward. The picture we presented here is just one version of what that looks like. This is a very simple case. It is what happens if we sort of dogmatically stick to $3 billion a year in new investments over the next 10 years. Further, what happens if every single one of the underlying assumptions, be they about returns, cash flow timing, growth of the overall pension plan, plays out exactly for the set of, per the set of assumptions we put in over a 10-year period. What I can say definitively is that scenario is not what's going to play out. I can further say, were it to play out, we wouldn't dogmatically stick to this plan. At some point on this timeline, we'd change our pacing approach. But the point is, we're going through the exercise, we're having the conversation. The result of that work this year, as it has been in the past, is that it is our recommendation to continue with our $2.5 to $3.5 billion pacing plan, certainly in 2021, probably 2022 and 2023 as well. This plan, by the way, does not include any additional work that we might be able to accomplish in the coming years on the enhanced monitoring and liquidity program front, so that we have that tool available to more actively manage this type of thing. Monica, I see you might have a question.
Yeah, just kind of, maybe it's not quick, but. Okay, so this shows us getting into our target asset allocation range in 2025, right, on this plan?
Getting back into the allocation range next year, being sort of in the middle of the range, 2024 is the way I would put it, yeah.
Oh.
A lot of, yeah. So you can see the solid line with the gray shading behind it. That line is our allocation. The access to the right is allocation relative to the total plan. So the middle line, the dotted line, is 17.5%. So where we cross that is where we are at exactly the middle part of the range.
Oh, okay. I read this wrong. Okay.
Yeah, it's not hard to do. There's a lot going on here. And there's I can't even begin to explain to you everything that's going on underneath the surface here, but it is a complex exercise, a complex tool, definitely not a precise tool. So, again, moving to slide 23, I'll go very fast on this. These are our five priorities for the coming year. We've already talked about new investment activity. We'll look to deploy $2.5 to $3.5 billion in new opportunities this year. With respect to number two, driving mitigation, fee mitigation, as we've talked about, the co-investment program is working. It is up and running. It is our staff's responsibility in collaboration with Pathway to continue to find ways to work our relationship, drive access and deal flow to that program. With number three, leveraging our pacing and portfolio management tools, as we've talked about already, we recognize that we are over-allocated to the asset class. We've taken some action already. We are in active dialogue, again, with Pete at Pathway about options for further activities there in the future. On the team, we have one opening, which we are looking to launch recruiting for immediately. So we'll rectify that over the course of the year. And number five on this list never changes. The subtext might change, but the main text never changes. Diligence and monitoring are areas of continuous improvement for us, so we never stop trying to sharpen our own toolkit and figure out how we can do a better job of those things. So page 24, I'll sort of stop where we started. So there's three, again, key takeaways we hope we've given you today. We understand how the long-term relative returns work. More importantly, we understand why they work that way. And we've got a plan in place to more consistently generate the type of returns on a relative basis going forward, or at least increase our probability of doing so. Secondly, we recognize that we are over-allocated. We've taken some action already. And we have the tools, again, in place to more effectively remain in compliance with our target allocation range going forward. Lastly, the sum of the prior two, we've significantly evolved our approach to this market over the last 5 years. I would characterize that as having been significant, almost revolutionary would be too strong of a word, but a period of big, big change. We have all the big picture parts of that in place today. We think we have the plan we need to remain competitive and hit our objectives going forward. But make no mistake about it, we will be required to continue to evolve going forward. This market is going to evolve around us. That might look like smaller change, point solutions, whatever it might be, but we're not resting on what we've done so far. So with that, I'm sure we're wildly over time, but I'm hoping that we might be able to answer some more questions that you might have.
Any questions of Mike? Well, Mike, we have an awful lot of respect for you, and we're believers. And by the way, congratulations on getting Jim Coulter, unless the credit goes to Rex. But
I think there's 30 years of Oregon history that get the credit for that. Well, thank you. And obviously, please digest. Me and Tom are always available to answer questions. We sort of parked some issues like benchmarking. Happy to take up those conversations offline as you see fit.
Good. Thank you. Mike Mueller, are you still available and online?
I am. Can you hear me, Chair Russell?
Yes. Yeah.
All right. I'll wait for Rex to catch up. Great. Thanks very much. Good morning, Chair Russell, members of the council. For the record, I'm Mike Mueller, an investment officer in the private markets team overseeing the opportunity portfolio. If you'll go to the next slide, I'll begin there with the agenda. But before I do, I'd be remiss if I didn't thank a couple members on our staff for helping with this presentation and, quite frankly, with the due diligence that we did on several investments in 2020. And most notably, Dana Milliken, who's an analyst on the private markets team, helped me with this presentation as well as some of the due diligence underwriting, and then also the operations and accounting staff for vetting the numbers that you'll see in this presentation. The agenda here is something you're familiar with now. What I would highlight for you is item 1D. These are the OIC investment beliefs. The opportunity portfolio, really, that one hits on the heart of what we're trying to accomplish with it, which is to exploit market inefficiencies. The OIC should be long-term, contrarian, innovative, and opportunistic in its investment approach. That really encapsulates what we're trying to do, encapsulates what we're trying to do with that portfolio. And I'll walk you through an overview of what this fund is designed to do in more detail, cover some of the performance since inception, and then give you the history, because I know for several of the board members, this may be their first time hearing about the opportunity portfolio, and it's nothing new. It's something that we've had in the portfolio for some time. Next slide, please. So the role of the opportunity portfolio is different from anything else in the pension fund. We don't have a strategic allocation that we're trying to hit, as you just heard from Mike Langdon, where he's trying to hit 17.5%. Rather, it's a place where we can do transactions or do deals that would otherwise fall by the wayside. That is, they don't fit neatly into any of the strategic asset classes of real estate, public equity, private equity, fixed income, et cetera. And historically, we would have just let them go again by the wayside. But by carving out a portion of the portfolio to do those deals, we were able to invest in them. And the goal is really to provide enhanced risk-adjusted returns for OPERF. And they can be shorter-term in nature or longer-term in nature. So there's no sort of set parameters by which we have to invest. Again, there's no strategic allocation, but the limit is at any point in time, we can't comprise more than 5% of the total pension fund assets. That was upped by the council last year when the target previously was 3%, or the limit, I should say, was 3%. The reason we increased it or asked for that increase and the council gave it was we had been invested at about 2.2%. And in the event of a market dislocation, as you'll hear, this is a place in the portfolio where we can lean into opportunities and be a little more tactical than we could otherwise be in some of the strategic allocations. From a return objective, the policy benchmark set by the council is CPI plus 5%. And the way I think about that is, since we're really borrowing allocation from the other strategic asset classes, is can we achieve the actual rate of return, since at least the actual rate of return, since we're borrowing allocation from those other parts of the portfolio. So think of that as 7 plus a little bit is our long-term return target. But not just that, but to do so in a manner that's uncorrelated with the rest of the OPERF holdings, and then to do it at a risk that's below that of the public equity component. And through its 15-year history, we've achieved those objectives, as you'll hear. In terms of the risk, the standard deviation of returns for this portfolio since inception are about 8.5%, which is slightly less than half of the public equity portfolio. Another interesting component of this slice of the fund is it's a place where we can incubate new strategies, right? So maybe it's something that looks a little fringe. We haven't done it before. We can sort of test drive it or try it out in the opportunity portfolio. And that's happened historically as it relates to bank loans and infrastructure. Bank loans, if you will, graduated to the public fixed income portfolio and became a sub allocation within public fixed income. And then within real assets, we seeded some infrastructure relationships early before we had the real assets portfolio, and it became a strategic allocation that Ben Mahon manages today. So the key components that I want you to think of when you think of the opportunity portfolio are twofold. One, there are niche strategies that just don't fit anywhere, and they can find a home in the opportunity portfolio. Historic examples include royalties, reinsurance, intellectual property, direct lending, and then multi-asset managers that, again, don't fit anywhere. And then the second component is when there's a market dislocation, and we've had a couple historical examples over the life of the portfolio, is we can invest and be a little more tactical. Again, examples go back to the bank loan market dislocation in 2008. There was a convertible bond strategy that we leaned into, and then this last year was more of a general credit focus, and I'll talk a little bit about how we deployed capital in that space. 2020, in a nutshell, was very busy. It was $775 million in new commitments to four funds that were focused across both niche strategies and dislocation strategies. Are there any questions sort of about the role and function of the opportunity portfolio before I press on? Great. Next slide, please. This year, this happens to be my favorite slide. It may not always be the case. Thanks to the accounting and operations staff, I was able to update performance through year-end. The fourth quarter was particularly strong for the portfolio. If you look at the bottom chart, the time-weighted rate of returns, as well as the graph to the right, over all time periods, the portfolio has exceeded the CPI plus 5 benchmark. And the since inception, the 15-year history, and a lot of credit goes to various members of the staff who've had a role in the underlying investments through its 15-year history, which I'll walk you through shortly. But we've met that 7% plus rate of return since inception. Next slide, please. So I want to spend a little bit of time here so you can appreciate the history of this program. It goes back to 2005 when there was a realization that were certain investments that we were just passing on because we didn't have a home for them. So with the help of PCA and Alan Emkin will remember this because he was around then as well, we created this portfolio and we began investing in 2006 with the first real investment for the fund. And then we were quickly met with the global financial crisis in 2007, 2008. As I mentioned, there was a bank loan market dislocation where prices dropped precipitously, but it didn't seem that they would hold. It was more liquidity driven. And so we with several of our partners, set up several funds where we invested in bank loans on both a levered and an unlevered basis. That was about the time, it was the time, that John Hershey joined the state treasury, 2008, as the first investment officer for this portfolio. And so he was key in setting up many of those relationships at that time. If you fast forward to 2009, 2010, it was relatively light deployment post the GFC. And then in 2011, we created that new alternatives portfolio that Ben Mahon now oversees and seeded three strategies out of the opportunity portfolio into his portfolio. And then in 2012 to 14, there was a realization that with our limited staff resources, it would behoove us to find partners that had a similar mindset in terms of looking at their strategies that would fulfill the role that we had for this mandate. And those key relationships continue today. Blackstone's Tactical Opportunities Fund is one that is a key relationship. And then the other I would point to is Sixth Street Partners, which was formerly a part of TPG, but early last year became independent of TPG. So view those relationships as an extension of staff, sort of long-term capital invested in opportunistic strategies. 2014 was key for the portfolio because that was the time that John Hershey was promoted to the Director of Alternatives. Why is that important? From 2014 until my appointment in 2019, there really was no day-to-day management of the opportunity portfolio. Fortunately, we were in a bull market, both in fixed income and public equity, so it was relatively stable to light deployment. We did invest in a couple strategies. If a staff member wanted to champion an idea that didn't fit anywhere within their portfolio, they could lead the underwriting and ride it through the due diligence process. So there were some strategies that went that way. And then finally, as I mentioned, last year was a busy year for us because we had the active pipeline from the dislocation opportunities that we evaluated for investment and commenced with a couple of those that I'll walk you through shortly. Next slide, please. So in the 2020 year in review, the portfolio today sits at $1.7 billion at approximately 2.2% of OPERF, well within that policy limit. During 2020, we re-upped with two direct lending managers. Since we don't have a private credit allocation, you'll see that there's roughly half the portfolios in credit-related strategies. Our Capital Corporation is a business development corporation that we'd invested with previously. And then Sixth Street raised their second specialty lending European fund, which we invested in as well. Those two commitments were $150 and $125 million respectively. As it relates to the dislocation, we were careful to we had several managers that we had met with that could have fulfilled this mandate. But given that we couldn't really meet anybody on site or do more thorough due diligence, we felt it was most appropriate to look to the partners that we already knew and to understand what their capabilities and thoughts were in the market. And that led to Oak Hill Advisors, which has been a long-term manager within the fixed income portfolio. They were raising a tactical investment fund, which was perfect for the mandate to invest across their platform. And then through the private equity relationship, Clear Lake was raising sort of an auxiliary fund to invest in both their debt and equity strategies, both dislocation-oriented, and then, again, things that would fall between the cracks of their typical fundraise. So those were the key developments in 2020 from a fundraising standpoint. I would also like to point out, and this is the fourth bullet point, the council and staff made a contingent commitment to Sixth Street's Adjacent Opportunities Fund. That's a mouthful to say that it's an extension of their strategy across their platform. And it was a contingent commitment in that it would only be triggered in the event of a market dislocation. So we had $200 million in commitment, dry powder, ready to go. It had a three-year duration. Fortunately for us, they activated it on April 1st to begin drawing down that capital. So we had some money ready to go in the event of a dislocation. And it's often best to have those set up in advance than to try to do it on the fly. Any questions so far? Great, thank you. Next slide, please. This slide, I just want to give you a sense for sort of the deal flow that I see. I wake up every day and my inbox is full with opportunities to invest. We try to capture that in our systems. I had over 200 points of contact within the last 12 months or so. The majority of those were for prospective managers. They can be inbound. Some of the better ideas either come from other folks on our staff in fixed income or in private equity, as I mentioned. A lot of the deal flow relates to private credit and direct lending. That was probably a third of those. Of those strategies, probably a dozen or so were flagged for high interest by me. I would elevate those to our internal team, the alternative team leads is what we call it. So to get a view of some of the staff members and recognize what are the merits and concerns of going forward with additional due diligence on a manager. So we vet that before we move forward. Of those eight, we closed on the four that you see below that I mentioned previously, with a total of $775 million committed in 2020, plus the additional $200 million that I mentioned from Sixth Street. Next slide, please. This is a snapshot of the portfolio today. You see we still have a relationship that goes back to 2007. There's 18 sort of relationships or partnerships today. Several of the smaller balances are in runoff from the dislocation in 2008. And then obviously the newer relationships that we started today, you won't see any fair market value yet. The unfunded commitment of the portfolio today is at $1.3 billion. And again, a big chunk of that was in 2020. Next slide, please.
Mike, on that slide, what does evergreen mean in this case?
Chair Russell, that means that it's an ongoing relationship. Think of it as a public equity manager where they will recycle the capital that they have at their disposal until we tell them to terminate it or dissolve the relationship.
Okay. So it's our decision, not theirs.
That's correct. Next slide, please. This slide shows the historical cash flows, similar to what Mike Langdon presented for private equity. I'd like to focus on the bottom half of this chart since it shows the episodic nature of investing in the opportunity portfolio. Particularly the yellow bar charts show the annual commitments. As I mentioned, 2007, 2008 were particularly active. Then more muted investments took place in the ensuing 4 years. And then we set up what I would call the strategic relationships in 13 and 14. And then I guess it's important to mention that that's when John Hershey left the day-to-day management of this portfolio. So from 15 through 19, it was sort of steady as she goes, and we had staff that would attend annual meetings and such and keep updated on the portfolio, but there was no single point of contact as we have again today. And then you'll see that uptick in commitments driven primarily by market dislocation in 2020. Again, a new high watermark for commitments. If Mike Langdon saw this chart relative to his portfolio, you guys should be concerned about that. But as it relates to the opportunity portfolio, since we're not trying to hit a strategic target, you should be less concerned about the episodic nature of investing because that's what it's designed to do. Next slide, please. This highlights the makeup of the managers in the portfolio today. What I'd highlight for you is five of the relationships comprise 80% of the net asset value today. We'll expand on that going forward, but there are some key relationships, as I mentioned, and that's partly due to staff resources and partly due to manager conviction that we have in those managers. Next slide, please. This is a breakdown of the sort of underlying assets. Again, I'm not trying to create a portfolio that is balanced in any way. It's a diversifier for the overall OPERF, not necessarily within the portfolio. But it breaks down roughly between 50% credit, 44% equity, and then we have a couple strategies related to royalties in pharma and media, and then we have a reinsurance manager as well. Next slide, please. I'm going to pass over this one in the interest of time. That just was the age of the relationships. Slide 13, I think, is important. If you look at the portfolio today from a fair market value standpoint, and I tell you it's an opportunity portfolio, you might ask, well, why are 4% of it tactical and 96% of it are these strategies that don't fit anywhere else? And that's really if you think about the last market dislocation, it was 12 years ago, right? So we would expect to see a lower allocation to tactical investments on a fair market value basis. I created the middle pie, which shows exposure, and that's defined as the fair market value of the underlying investments plus unfunded commitments that we made. And that you'll see, a quarter of the fund is tactical based on that measure. And that's important because going forward, that tactical piece will continue to grow as that capital is deployed primarily over the next 2 to 3 years. Next slide, please. Slide 14, I include just for information. The board should not look at the opportunity portfolio as a source of liquidity. That's what public equity and public fixed income are for. But roughly a third of the portfolio is generally pretty liquid in that we could liquidate it within 30 days, publicly traded securities, if not shorter. Another third are semi-liquid, that is, they trade quarterly or have semi-annual redemption rights. And then about 40% you should think of as sort of traditional private equity-like with longer term investment periods that you're all familiar with. Next slide, please. So I'll wrap up with this slide. So looking forward, the opportunity portfolio has bandwidth and capital to deploy as new strategies arise or if we're presented with new market stresses, which hopefully we're not, but we have capital ready to deploy. We're currently engaged in several strategies, in niche strategies for the first half of this year, so it's a robust pipeline for us. And bond spreads remain low, equity multiples are high, so it's not particularly conducive to tactical investing today. But there are always innovations in the marketplace and interesting things that we can deploy capital into. And then the last point I want to make is the final bullet point here, because I know it's a new strategic initiative for the council. And that is when we evaluate general partners within the opportunity portfolio, just as we do across the platform, ESG risk as well as diversity inclusion efforts will be explored with the managers as part of our standard due diligence process. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions that you may have.
This is Member Samples. I am the OIC member that sits on the Alternatives Committee, which includes the Opportunity Fund. So I just wanted to kind of share one, it's a question and something that I think about. There's probably not an answer right now, but something for everyone to think about is that due to the dual nature of the mandate, right, niche strategies that don't fit anywhere within the asset allocation, which we could be investing in at any time, right, kind of a best ideas, but where does it go type of a thing, as well as the sort of tactical opportunistic deployment of capital in market dislocations. And with a cap, right, on the total amount that we want exposed, we could find ourselves in a situation where there is a major market dislocation, an opportunity to take advantage of all sorts of tactical opportunities, but we are not in a position to, because we have filled up all of our capacity with these niche strategies. And so, you know, I don't know what the answer to that is. It's not something that we've run into before, but it could present a challenge in the future, and we may want to be prepared for that and think about it ahead of time.
Yeah, Vice Chair Samples, what I would say to that is you're absolutely right, and I think that was the foresight that the council had last year when we increased that upper limit from 3% to 5%. And as managing the portfolio, I don't view it as let's fill it up with niche strategies. Sort of rule of thumb for me is I'm going to leave some bandwidth, at least 2%. And 2% of the pension fund is a significant amount that would allow us to invest in dislocation opportunities when they arise. We can think about that, to your point, and craft something in policy if that would be of interest to the council going forward. But that's sort of the rule of thumb right now. that I operate under.
That makes sense. And yeah, I don't think we're in a situation right now or a decision-making point where we would say, oh, we'd like to craft a policy, but something for a future discussion.
Very good.
Okay, no further questions. Mike, thank you.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
John Hershey?
Yes, John Hershey, Director of Investments. First off, apologize for the street noise surrounding me. And Chair Russell, members of the Council, thank you for your patience for waiting for the highlight of the agenda. As much as I'd really like to say that I certainly can't, but this is an annual disclosure. I've been doing it for the last number of years. By policy, we're meant to disclose to the Council any recommendations that staff has made where it's had contact with a placement agent. 2020 was pretty straightforward. There are no recommendations that were made where we had contact with a placement agent. I've confirmed that with each of the portfolio managers for private equity, real estate alternatives, and the opportunity portfolio. So with that, I'll open it up to questions.
Well done, John. Efficiently done.
I knew I could help bring this back up closer to time.
Yeah, yeah. No further questions of John? If so, next item on the agenda is the general consultants. And why don't we start with Aon? And these are self-introductions.
Okay, thank you, Chair Russell. This is Kristen Doyle from Aon, and good morning. I guess good afternoon now. On behalf of the Aon investment team, I can say we're really excited to be attending our first OIC board meeting. Apologies for us not being on video today. Technology is not cooperating, but we hope by the next meeting you'll be able to see our faces, and hopefully a few meetings from now we'll be in person. We just wanted to introduce ourselves quickly. So I'll start, and then I have a couple colleagues that are on the line with me. So like I said, my name's Kristen Doyle. I'm the lead on the Oregon relationship on the Aon side. This is a little bit of background. I've been working with public funds my entire career, which started at the Northern Trust Company, and then after a few years landed me at Ennis Knupp & Associates, which now is obviously Aon Investments. So I've been with the collective firms for 15 and a half years now, and I currently co-lead our public sector practice in North America, as well as working directly with some of our large public fund clients, namely the state of Florida, Minnesota, and New Jersey. As I mentioned, I have two colleagues on the line with me today, Renine Jalajal, who will be working very closely with me on this relationship. She concentrates most of her time on some of our largest and more complex, sophisticated investment clients. And she recently received a very important promotion to associate partner, which for us is one level below partner. So you have a very senior team coming to you from Aon. And I think importantly, too, she works really closely with me on the New Jersey Division of Investments. Renine, do you want to add anything on your experience for the council?
Yeah, sure. So this is Renine Jalajal. I've been with Aon for about 10 years now working with clients on asset allocation, developing investment policy to reflect best practices, as well as helping improve outcomes through portfolio construction. I also was a senior member of the Trust Services team for 7 years, a team that Kristen led at that time, where we worked closely together evaluating securities lending programs and leading large transition events. And I have to say I'm really excited to be working with you all. Look forward to partnering with the Investment Council and Makita on a number of initiatives you have for the year.
Great. Thanks,
Renine.
Thanks. Yep. We also have Steve Cummings on the line with us. He manages our investment business globally, but also has a very long history of working with some of our largest public clients. Some notable involvements I would point out were working for the U.S. Treasury on the TARP program in the 2007-2008 GFC. And he was also at one point the interim CIO at the North Carolina Public Pension System, among other notable experiences. So while Renine and I will do most of the talking, if there are questions today, Steve is obviously a very important participant and member of this team and will be available to answer any questions that might come up as well. But maybe I'll pause and see if Steve does want to say anything at this point.
Too bad not to have video. Is that going to be a permanent problem?
No, we're working on it right now. We've tried a number of different ways to solve for the issue, and so far we just haven't been able to fix that.
I'm sure we'll figure it out. This is Steve, just adding my thanks, and we're grateful for the opportunity. And as Krista mentioned, I will be available as needed. I spend a great deal of my time on administrative and supervisory work running the business globally, but I still get involved in client work in our public sector. And just a quick note, I just noted my son's plane just landed at PDX. He has returned to the Portland area, so we have a personal presence in your neighborhood.
Great. Thanks, Steve. And so I'll just conclude. I know we're running out of time here. Again, we are excited to be here. Hopefully you'll see our faces at the next meeting, and you have a lot on your agenda this year that we are looking forward to engaging with you on.
Good. Now, Makita, Alan Emkin, you want to handle that?
Thank you. Meek and I will do it, but we will be quick in recognizing the time. First and foremost, I want to thank you on behalf of all of us for expanding our long-term relationship. We are truly excited and thrilled to be working with you, the staff, and Aon on this assignment. We've been busy getting up to speed on many fronts, working with the staff and having met with all of the board members, with the exception of Mr. Olenek, who we plan to meet with shortly. We have a large team committed to this assignment. There are four partners, three of them based in Portland in Slab City, or Slab Town, who will be working with you, Mika and I, and Mika will be there shortly to talk to you through this slide. We'll be joined by two other partners, Paola Nealon and Colin Beebe. Just for your information, Paola, before she joined Makita, worked for the Treasurer's Office doing equity work with your team. And Colin and I have worked together for 11 years. His first job out of undergraduate was at PCA, so his whole career has been working with us. We're supported by a large team of researchers in Boston and San Diego. And in addition to investment research, we're doing technology research and administrative research. And we are truly thrilled at the opportunity of working with you. And, Mr. Chairman, I'm going to be jumping off shortly because I have an appointment to get vaccinated.
We're all jealous.
So I'm signing off. Thank you, and take care. It's up to Mika.
All right. Thanks, Alan, and good afternoon, everyone. I will, as Alan said, keep this very brief. I know that you've had a long agenda before you already this morning. Mostly wanted to just spend a moment on this slide to highlight that while our contract was only formally signed for January 1, there's been a lot of work that's taken place. So through the conversations we've been able to have with individual council members, I think we've highlighted some of this, but sometimes it's nice to just see kind of in a graphic where we sit today and what some of the undertakings are that Makita has begun and also that we're working with staff on. And I appreciated the Aon introductions. I think we're also looking forward to working with that team and providing just the best advice that we can to the council. I'm only going to highlight a couple of these items and then, you know, certainly can take questions if there are any regarding the work that's being done. A couple of the major areas of work, if you look at the top of this slide, you see consolidating and revising OIC policies. This is a big undertaking. John Hershey is leading the effort on the staff side. I know this is an objective for Rex this year. You can see it's kind of the blue highlighting there shows it being a 2021 project. I expect that that's pretty accurate. It's a big task. Makita's here working with John and helping to review and consider ways to better streamline those policies, make sure they're all working together and functioning properly, and maybe hopefully at the end of the day you won't have several dozen, but we can consolidate a bit. In terms of asset allocation, I'd say this is the next big item that you'll be hearing from Makeda and I assume Aon on quite a bit. And I wanted to give all of the council members a heads up that after this meeting, probably Monday would be my guess because no one likes to receive a survey on a Friday, but on Monday, our goal is to send out a survey that we've worked with staff to create to really ask for three things from council members. We're looking to get perspective on really risk and how risk is viewed across the council and how that can factor into the asset allocation process. So we'll be looking at objectives. So what do you each believe the objectives are of the portfolio? Then moving into risk appetite, how much appetite is there for risk beyond what's already in the portfolio today? Maybe there's none, maybe there's less risk appetite. Risk mitigation, so what can be done to help balance the portfolio in that way? And finally, implementation, so how should the portfolio be managed across the allocation over time? So it's a relatively brief survey. We really look forward to getting those responses. We'll be able to bring back those responses as well as our capital market assumptions to the March meeting and go over those with the council, and that really kicks off the process. We're already working with staff on our capital market assumptions, actually just came out for 2021 this past week. So we'll be working to customize those for the OPERF portfolio really over the coming weeks, and really look forward to presenting that in March. If you continue down the slide a bit, the only other items I wanted to note is we are well underway in gathering the data needed to produce performance reporting for you. I think you'll see a change to how performance reporting is handled. On the consulting side, the goal is to make this as useful for you as council members as possible. So more executive summary and action-oriented items and less just pages of detail. That will certainly be available to you, but maybe won't be the focus of the presentation. And then finally, I wanted to note on the ESG and diversity and inclusion front, and I heard from two of your asset classes today that mentioned this, you know, this is an area that I know Rex has prioritized, I know you as a council have prioritized, and both Makeda and Aon, I think, are really looking forward to working with staff to further integrate these principles into your investment portfolio, to bring you best practices from the industry, what we're seeing among other public and private plans, and to work together to continue to elevate the status of the OIC and the OPERF portfolio from an ESG and a diversity and inclusion standpoint. With that, I will take any questions that you might have on these items. Again, it's been a really exciting, really 2 months. We got started a little early with staff, and I'm really looking forward to working with you all through the course of 2021.
Questions of Mika? Thank you, Mika. A lot of work ahead. So welcome aboard.
Thank you.
Rex, asset allocation?
Sure. Make sure my voice is on. For the record, Rex Kim, Chief Investment Officer. On the screen, you'll see the asset allocation. This is as of year-end, December 31st. As we are all aware, for OPERF, really the primary asset class that is still slightly above the upper range is private equity, but as we are aware, there are various tools in place to help us get that allocation back in line with at least underneath the upper range. And then for the allocation for SAFE is reasonably in line. And then for the Common School Fund, as the members are aware, some of these asset classes are sort of newer in their life cycle, so real estate and alternatives, and so those are being built out, and therefore the allocation you see for those asset classes are a little bit lower than target. But again, these are also areas where we don't want to get overly aggressive. We want to be very thoughtful about allocating dollars with a thoughtful pacing strategy there as well. Same information, just a slightly different look. And then year-end NAV for OPERF, a brand-new high watermark. And we will go further into performance details, I believe, at the next meeting, if I am remembering correctly. Very similarly for SAFE, that is also hitting a new high watermark, and then also the same for Common School Fund. And then in terms of the forward calendar, you'll see it on our screen here. The one thing that I do want to note, however, there are some changes forthcoming. So as Mika noted, for the March meeting, we will start the asset allocation discussion process. Historically, we had left that up to a single meeting. What we are going to try to do this time is try to break up that discussion over a series of meetings, starting with, in the March meeting, we'll have a discussion about capital markets assumptions, and then also that risk survey. Oops, that's Siri listening to me. And then from there, one of the other changes that will happen in the April meeting is we'll have a little bit of a deeper dive discussion about various sort of aspects of a risk. And then in the June joint session with the PERS board meeting, we will have the OPERF asset allocation discussion.
Rex, is the assumption that these will be virtual until proven otherwise?
Realistically, yes. Yes.
That's too bad. Well, that finishes the regular agenda. It's time for open discussion among OIC members, staff, consultants. Nobody's been shy during all this entire session, so I'm pleased about that.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with you that too bad for a variety of reasons, and one of them is just the I've discovered the anew today. Our kids have the unerring ability to pick the time when Heidi and I both have significant meetings for their crises. So my apologies for being gone for the last couple of minutes. Things are sort of under control again.
And the dogs, yeah.
Just one, that she's okay, yeah.
No, it's a crazy world. Yeah. You know, I've never met Monica, which is, that's just.
That's amazing.
That's crazy. That's crazy.
Don't build it up too much, John.
It'll be great when it happens.
I'd have to travel to Florida, right? Which I would do.
That'd be nice.
Any public comment, May? Good. Well, it appears we're adjourned. Take care.
Thank you, everybody. Thank you, everyone.
Thank you.